Hello, everybody. Welcome to the inaugural episode of The Trademarks. Yes, it's a witty title for this show. I'm Dylan Hales, the host of the Wrestling Culture Podcast, which can be found at theplacetobenation.com. And I'm here with my fellow co-host, David Bixenspan of WrestlingObserver.com. And this is a new venture in podcasting. It's something that, to my knowledge, has never been done before, certainly not as a series, at least. It is a podcast that's going to focus on pro wrestling in a slightly different manner than anything else that's been done. We're going to look at intellectual property. We're going to look at business models. We're going to look at the sort of areas where the wrestling world overlaps with the business world, but in not necessarily in the sort of big picture stockholder way, but on the micro level, you know, the history of tape trading, the history of, independent wrestling, the ideas behind streaming services, YouTube, things of that nature. These are all things that we're eventually going to look at over the course of this series. Today on the inaugural episode, we have a lot of stuff to cover. This is Mania Weekend as we're recording this. I don't know when you're listening to this, but as we record this, it is basically the week before Mania, I should say, not Mania Weekend. And we're going to be looking at several different topics, some of which directly relate to WrestleMania, some of which relate to sort of controversies that have popped up regarding internet piracy, which, of course, is going to be something that we'll be covering a lot on this podcast series. But as it goes, we're looking at all that stuff this week and a bunch of other stuff similarly themed going forward. David, how are you today?
I am doing well.
Well, you know, this is something that I have thought of. This podcast is something that I've considered doing before. As I said in the intro, you know, I am the co-host of the Wrestling Culture Podcast with my buddy Dave Musgrave, and we cover a lot of sort of different topics, big picture topics, broader spectrum topics. But this is something that, to me at least, really deserves its own podcast in and of itself, because this is a reoccurring issue. The issue of intellectual property in pro wrestling, internet piracy in pro wrestling, things of that nature. This is something that's constantly going on. It never ends. And it's something that I believe is, you know, kind of intimately wedded to the history of hardcore wrestling fandom, or whatever term you want to use to describe sort of, the sort of people that would be listening to the show, frankly. I was to the point, I thought about, you know, doing a show on my show about it, or doing a single show of this with David. But to me, this is something that deserves a bigger picture, longer spectrum look, because these issues are not going to die. This is good. This is something that with the internet and with the sort of landscape being what it is, they're constantly going to be coming up in new and different ways over time. And there's constantly going to be issues related to this. So I really wanted to do this show, and David stepped in and said, hey, I think this is a good idea. This is something that I kind of want to do too. So hopefully this is something that we can sort of stretch out and make we can trademark it over time. Because I really do think that this is an interesting topic that's not really been covered a lot of other places. Have you seen a lot of coverage of this other than maybe in this week's Figure Four? have you seen a lot of this sort of thing covered in any really serious way before?
Gathered together? No. I mean, when stories come up, yeah.
Yeah, but you know, there's just I just feel like there's a this is something that it comes up a lot. Yes. And sometimes it's really relatively minor, or sometimes it may be things that we don't even necessarily connect to being intellectual property related issues. Like, for example, who owns a video library would be a great example of that. But I feel like this is just something, given the current media landscape and, you know, how everything's sort of gone digital, of course, at this stage, I feel like this is something that is basically hangs over the entire head of modern wrestling as we know it. And to me, it's something that deserves more intensive and more serious coverage, and really a broad range of approaches. You know, I'll be open right out of the gate. I think it's only honest for me to be open right out of the gate, because I'm going to be the radical on this. I don't even believe in intellectual property. as a philosophical matter. I don't believe in such a thing. Obviously, there are laws that tell me I'm wrong, but from a purely philosophical perspective, I don't even believe in it. Having said that, you know, I'm not the type of person who goes to torrent sites. In fact, I don't ever go to torrent sites. I don't even download music. A lot of people will hear that and think that's BS, but it's true. I don't do it ever. But, you know, from a philosophical perspective, I'm probably going to be the radical end of this discussion, whereas I think you're maybe a little bit more moderate than me. do you have any biases that you want to declare before we start tackling today's topics?
Not really, no. I did want to add, especially just to kind of come off of what you were saying, that this is not just going to touch on copyright infringement and all that stuff. And you mentioned video libraries, something I kind of forgot to put in our little rundown that we put together before we started recording. And just as an example of that, I don't think it's something we can really have any reason to get into this week because there's not any real details yet. But for example, something I'm sure we'll talk about as we know more about it is going to be the NWA Classic Service, for example.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, to me, all that sort of stuff, business models, you know, all of that, you know, new streaming technologies, all that stuff sort of falls under the rubric of what I'm looking to do and what I believe you're looking to do with this podcast, because it's interesting stuff, and it's stuff that sort of combines, you know, the modern technology, which I know is something that you're super into, that you're like, and, you know, sort of the issue of IP, which is something that I'm super into. There's a lot of overlap there, and I think in both cases, there's not a whole lot of people that are covering it with the sort of detail that it deserves. So, yeah, we're going to be doing all of the above, and I'm open to suggestions from listeners. I'm open to people ripping me apart if they think I'm too radical on certain things. I'm absolutely open to engaging on that level as well. As long as it's civil, of course, or reasonably civil as it could be with a subject like this, I suppose.
And if you want to hit us up on Twitter, Dylan is at Dylan Waco, and I am at David Bix.
Absolutely. Yes, that's. I always forget to plug Twitter, so I'm glad you did it for me, because I'm not very good at plugging mine. Right. Well, we've got a few topics to discuss today.
We picked a good week to start.
Yes, I think a very good week to start. Or maybe this week picked us, I guess, in a way, because I don't know that this ever would have gotten off the ground without this week. Maybe,
yes.
I don't know. But why don't you sort of start us on the topics there, and where do you want to start off? I have an idea where you want to start off, but where do you want to start off, and how do you want to frame this here?
Well, we'll start with the one that got the most mainstream news coverage, which would be the arrest of Sir Paul. One of the best-known UFC and WWE and maybe some other stuff, capturers, and is that the term we'd use? Capturers?
I suppose.
And torrent uploaders, you know, guy that would just use his capture card to capture pay-per-views and all that, TV shows, etc., and put them on torrent sites. As it usually seems to be with wrestling, it was just one guy, actually a 55-year-old British gentleman. And the reason I note that is because with movies especially, because there's so much coordination going on, and to an extent with music and some other stuff, like TV shows, you have groups that also use these names. And this goes back with the whole concept of the... And I think I linked the Wikipedia article about it when I mentioned the Sir Paul arrest in the Observer Daily Update during the week. You have what are called wares scene groups. And I guess no one really uses the term wares anymore, do they?
No. Not that I've seen in quite some time, anyway.
So wares with a Z was at first referred just to, I guess you would say, pirated. I mean, we're going to use the term pirated, I think, just because it is the most accepted term. I don't like using it. That's definitely one of my biases, because I think it's turning what it is, whether you think it's right or wrong, and even if you think it's wrong, I think it's exaggerating it way too much. Piracy is the Somalian pirates pillaging ships. That's actual piracy. So I don't like, it's a loaded word, and people don't treat it as a loaded word, but because it is the most commonly used word, and otherwise you're doing verbal gymnastics saying, unauthorized or whatever. I think we can agree, though, that it's the most commonly used word, and we're not going to change anyone's minds about using it, so we'll say piracy, correct?
That's the assumption that I'm running with, yes.
Okay, so piracy. So wares originally referred to pirated software, mostly games, but also productivity applications, all that. But eventually it referred to the whole umbrella of pirated, unauthorized copies of everything, music, movies, everything. So over the years, there started to become groups that released things. And they would, you know, for example, software, they would crack the copy protection. Or, you know, with movies, they would coordinate who would be able to get a clean audio track to go with a decent-looking copy that someone was able to manage to shoot in an empty theater, or something like that. And I guess they still exist, and I would guess they mainly just exist for movies. And then, you know, in wrestling and other things like that, a lot of the time it's just one guy. So Sir Paul was among the most prolific with WWE and UFC. And he got arrested, and it got a lot of mainstream coverage, mostly in the UK, maybe a little bit in Ireland, too. You know, I always try to make sure to separate the UK and Ireland.
It's important.
Because I know our friends hate that. And it got a lot of coverage, you know, most prolific UFC and WWE pirate, all the data he uploaded, the number of hours of programming, etc. They made this out to be a pretty big deal. As far as we can tell, he's already out of jail. May have even gotten out of jail within the day of his arrest. He was already posting online. I don't think he was posting stuff. I would hope not. And the thing is, and I mean, the reason we're probably not going to end up talking about this too much, really not going to change anything.
No. I think... What it is, this example of the futility of even addressing piracy this way, because it is not going to stop piracy at all. It is not going to decrease it. It at most will cause a minor inconvenience for people who are looking for pirated content. I mean minor. It's not as if this
the is the only one.
Yeah.
Not by a long shot.
This is, you know, I think the theory behind this is if you go forward with a serious and stringent prosecution against somebody like this, you can make an example out of them, right? I mean, that's always the theory with these, is that we're going to make an example out of these people, and when that happens, they'll all stop. Well, you know, I don't. This is not a explicitly political podcast, but I would note that if that was the case, I couldn't walk down the street, you know, two doors away from mine and buy a bag of weed relatively easily. the reality is that's just not how it works. Once an activity becomes as pervasive as smoking pot or pirating material, it doesn't really make much of a difference whether or not you punish somebody severely if you catch them. That's not an argument. I do want to make this clear, regardless of my own biases. That's not an argument that means piracy is okay. But this is a story, I think, because of the size, I suppose, the volume of content that this guy was involved in distributing.
Or the perceived size might be a better way to put it.
That's actually probably a better way to put it. But the reality is it's not – It's really a minor story because it doesn't even cause a bottleneck, really. I mean, there's only a minor hiccup in the access, and I mean a very minor hiccup, almost so small it's not even couldn't be measured in terms of access to content. So this is one of those things where I think it's a relevant story for this show, obviously because of what our theme is, but it's also a relevant story and probably not a bad story to start things off with, just because I think it points to the futility of even trying this approach. I mean, if you go after somebody legally and you believe it's your right under the law and blah blah blah, forget what I think about it. Forget the morals of it. Forget any of that. Legally, you have the right to do that. But if you think it's going to make a dent in piracy, the evidence is overwhelming that it's not. And I suspect on future shows we'll get into.
Well, not just future shows. We're going to be talking about that a lot today.
Well, sure. But I mean, like, in general, there are bigger cases. Like, I mean, I for example, we could down the road. I think we could do an entire show, for example, on the history of Mega Upload if we wanted to. I'm not even going to touch that today. But my point is, Mega Upload, just as an example, is a site that was used for quite a while housing tons of pirated content. And you know, the issue there, the government came cracking down in this case, and all sorts of, frankly, craziness, going on, and it's very, very serious amounts of jail time and fines and everything else being thrown about, and it's done nothing to slow the access of pirate.
Well, the same guy has another site, though. I mean, it's different. It's not. It doesn't encourage piracy in the way that's been argued that Mega Upload did, Correct me if I'm wrong. Mega Upload was one of the sites that would pay people if they got certain amounts of downloads on their file.
I believe that's correct.
Okay, right. Which, you know, there are all sorts of arguments there, but you can also say if someone was using it for their own stuff and their own stuff got popular, it's the same thing. I mean, but it's tough. I mean, but that is the sites that did that, I would say there is a more legitimate case against them. Because it was kind of obvious.
Sure, it's monetizing the content in a secondary fashion. That's an entirely different debate. I almost don't even want to get into it.
Right, because I mean, Sir Paul, as far as I know, was not making a cent off anything.
No, and that really speaks to really the issue with a lot of this is a lot of what is often identified as piracy. And I suppose is piracy by definition, or the definition of the term that's usually used, is people who are not profiting in any way. I mean, they're not making money off of it. That's not universally the case, certainly. I would never say that. But in many, many cases, particularly when it comes to torrent sites and digital downloads and things of that nature, we're not talking about people who are making money. They're not making a commercial profit. In fact, in some cases, you could argue they're losing money. So this is not a money-making scheme, which is really lays at the heart of the issue regarding piracy, I think, because then the issue becomes, well, if you're not making money off of this, how is this any different than loaning your friend your CD? And, you know, that's a philosophical argument, and there's all sorts of
– And way too involved to have right now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right now is not the time for that.
Now, one thing I will say they did right, if you're going to go after someone, and also something we should get into is that this is a criminal case and not a civil case. If you're going to do this, that I'll say you did it right. They did go after the scene release capture uploader group. I'm making air quotes with my hand that you can't see, as opposed to just individual users, which... I always got the feeling the content companies did not understand how that worked until recently.
Well, it just looks bad when you're going after a 14-year-old kid for using Napster. You know, yeah. I mean, like, again, that has absolutely nothing to do with whether or not you think it's morally wrong, legally wrong, whatever. And actually, to be honest, I actually do think a lot of this is morally wrong. I think ideally you should be paying people for content. I just don't believe intellectual property exists. I don't believe there's a philosophical basis for it. But that doesn't mean you should be going around and just taking things left and right. Ideally, you still support what you consider good and what you consider worth your money. Going after the low-level sort of minor users of it doesn't work. I mean, to use the drug analogy, it's like going after the guy who gets busted for smoking a joint as opposed to the cartel. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't do any good. So from that perspective, yeah, sure. I mean, if you are going to go after this, you theoretically should be going after the top dogs who are distributing the content, not the people who are using it.
But it was done in a genre where he'll be easily replaced, where he did not bring anything unique to the table, and where it was just one guy. And there are – and now I believe the that other UFC case that got a lot of press I believe that I don't remember his real name, but I remember the name for the articles that he used, because when you started looking in comments and stuff, they always used his username. I think it was Secludedly, who was a guy who I think it turned out was like ill, maybe had some other issues. It did ask for donations, but barely got any. Used it to buy some medication that wasn't covered, whatever. He had his specialty was that he had some obscure cable company or something that had like the high frame rate versions of UFC programming. So, you know, if you followed it all with some of the movies, like what am I thinking of? Like, I guess Peter Jackson movies or some of the James Cameron stuff, that they'll use cameras that have higher frame rates, the number of frames that comprise each second of a movie. And higher frame rate means that the motion is smoother, and then with sports, you can see movement easier, et cetera, et cetera. It doesn't blur. He was the one guy who was able to get this stuff. So once UFC sued him and he wasn't around anymore, that was something that actually was no longer in the pipeline. So that, I mean, you can argue about whatever else you want with that case, but that UFC at least did, I guess, take care of something there when they sued that guy. But it's also, you probably had people in that case who were even buying the pay-per-views who were maybe curious to see that because they couldn't get it themselves, which is another part of this that, well, I think is probably better suited for what our big discussion will be.
I think so, too. That gets into the issue of market demand and how that relates to this, and I think that's an important issue, but I think it's better suited for the big topic that we'll be discussing toward the end of the show.
Yeah, and something I get the feeling we're going to be talking about that a lot. Is it available? Is there a demand for it? If it's not available and you're otherwise supporting them, is it okay to get X thing, etc.? So I guess that's really all there is to say about Sir Paul for now.
Yes.
So moving on, this is not exactly, I mean, I guess it's possible that this is a story that is going on right now. We just don't know. My best guess would be yes. WWE, my understanding is at least the last few years they've definitely done it, and it's possible they've at least tried doing this going on and off the past decade or so. In the area surrounding WrestleMania each year, generally they've been, I think, going for a 5-mile radius. They will file a John Doe lawsuit, meaning they don't know who they're suing yet, in the jurisdiction of WrestleMania. Basically, because they need the power to be able to seize merchandise, etc., because they don't know who the heck's going to be there. And I sort of get what they're doing, and I mean, and I don't really know why they file it under seal, which is why we don't know if anything has happened yet. Because in past cases, it eventually got unsealed, but if they file the lawsuit under seal and the judge grants it, it's not public unless somehow it gets unsealed. So this is something they've been doing for the last few years, and it really got attention starting with WrestleMania 29, because that was the first year that we had WrestleCon. And what do you remember hearing when that went down? Because it was all of a sudden. I think it was on the Sunday, so I think it was WrestleMania Sunday, that it was maybe even late. I think it was near the end of WrestleCon, because I think WrestleCon, well, you didn't go, but I think you didn't go to any of the WrestleMania stuff that year, right?
I did not.
But I think it was fairly late in WrestleCon, because I think they closed relatively early on Sunday for obvious reasons, that WWE came in, I guess, with some government agents, maybe some federal marshals or something, and started seizing, I guess the term here would be to use counterfeit merchandise, or what they deemed counterfeit merchandise. And if they've been doing like they've been doing the previous several years, they're probably going to try to do this again this weekend in some form or fashion. And I recently got a hold of some of the stuff from last year's case, because they ended up having some trouble with the judge and appeals and all that. Because they, you know, that they have to defend to be able to keep doing this, because they don't want a precedent against them. And it had some of the stuff from the WrestleMania 29 weekend seizures, and I will see if I can find that. But generally speaking, they are going after straight-up counterfeiters when they do this. People who are standing near the stadium selling straight-up counterfeit WrestleMania t-shirts with photos of the wrestlers in the main events, etc., on them. that is the that is the bulk of what they are going after and trying to get. However, WrestleCon was the first year that you had this ongoing thing within a 5-mile radius of WrestleMania that could conceivably have something they would go after. Any other, there have been indie shows now going back a decade surrounding WrestleMania, but WrestleCon had, and what people and what they ended up, you know, kind of seizing, in addition to, I guess they did find the t-shirts from a few people, but they see some counterfeit posters. They seized custom action figures, which I thought was interesting, and that might be something to talk about. Custom action figures being when people kind of Frankenstein old action figures together, repaint them, try to do them up nice to look like wrestlers who were not part of that action figure line, whether older wrestlers or newer wrestlers, depending on what toys they're using to put them together. And also the only DVDs, which I'm trying to figure out if I should say the name of who it was or not, because some people listening will know who it is. I forget. Have I talked to you about this in the past, who this was?
I don't think so.
I mean, it's public record, so what do you think?
It's public record. Put it out there.
Well, you know what? People know, you know what? People know what happened, so I don't want to. What do you think?
Just say it.
Okay,
I'll take the heat.
Bill Brown.
Okay.
You know who that is?
Yeah.
Okay. Bill Brown, I guess best known online as Wild B. Brown. He had gotten a booth there, and he was selling various wares, and he ended up on the wrong side of that. And I have no idea how it ended up, but he was added as a defendant. But it was, I think him and the custom action figures and the posters were really the only ones that were not your usual counterfeit WrestleMania fare. And it's worth noting, he had other stuff, but everything that they took pictures of and they showed in this list was stuff with recent WWE trademark logos on it, for whatever it's worth.
Yeah, I mean, this is tough, because despite my philosophical stand, I think there is something, you're really playing with fire. To collect publicly in a in a space like that, and sell things that you know are infringe on trademark.
And it's worth pointing out that High Spots, who run and operate WrestleCon, did make everyone sign that they would not have any kind of counterfeit bootleg, whatever merchandise.
That is important. We should note that, because that is significant. But that is that's. You're asking for it. I mean, frankly, you know, and I think that's one of the issues around an event like WrestleCon that's tough is, you know, on the one hand, there's all this, frankly, cool stuff. If you're a wrestling geek, as we are, as probably anybody listening to this is. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, you are opening yourself up, especially because the interpretation of what is or isn't a piece of intellectual property, you know, legally, I'm sure it's well, actually, it's debatable, but legally, in theory, it's relatively cut and dry on certain things, but in actual fact, it's actually kind of fluid. I mean, for example, custom made action figures, that's tough.
I didn't like that. I really,
that's a tough one. I
have that page up now. I mean, not all the pictures are, it's, you know, it's not all high resolution, but I'm going to try to see what I can see. You can't really see that much in the photos. So it's referred to as during WrestleMania events, seized from, you know what, I'll give the name, Kenneth Assel from East Berlin, Connecticut. And it says, he notes, he was served. Now, 11 action figures seized. It's worth pointing out that there are a lot more than 11 figures in the tubs in the pictures.
Yeah.
So, and you know, the one they spotlight in its own picture is labeled as Triple H with WWE belt. What I'm going to guess is they seized anything that had a sticker with a trademarked wrestler name and or the letters WWE.
Oh, that's very possible.
Because I just don't think, and especially depending on how much painting was involved, I don't think it's that easy to justify someone's really just putting all this stuff together and painting it up, going after those.
It's hard to imagine how it would be. But, you know, if you're David fighting against Goliath in a case like that, what are you going to do? You know, I mean, that's the other issue here is, and we've seen this even with the WWE trying to you know, basically create a belt around WrestleMania area this year out near Santa Clara, where only WWE it can run. You know, the infamous booking the indies out of the building strategy, if you believe in that. I mean, some people think that's a little bit overstated, but I mean, there's...
Well, it's what they're doing, but it's not necessarily... They're not necessarily doing it for the reason...
For that reason.
Well, I mean, it's mixed. They... I think we can... You know, for example, you know, we're recording this less than 48 hours after the death of Paraguayo Jr. They worry something will happen at a WrestleMania weekend indie card, and WrestleMania and WWE will get invoked in headlines.
Yes.
Which is something that happened to some degree this weekend with Rey Mysterio and Paraguayo Jr.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, I that's part of it. You know, I mean, but the issue here is...
And yes, they do, but, you know, there are people there who resent the indie shows piggybacking, for lack of a better word, but I think in the grand scheme of things, their primary concern is avoiding anything that could end up reflecting on them in some bad way.
Well, here's the other deal too, and I think this is something that's worth mentioning in this particular context. Mm-hmm. The WWE benefits dramatically from things like WrestleCon and these indie shows.
Oh yeah,
and for two reasons. More than two, but two that I think are worth pointing out. The first is that if people are spending all this money on these events and all this merchandise, it stands to reason that a lot of them are also spending money and merchandise at WrestleMania itself.
Yeah.
But the second and I think more compelling and interesting reason, and the reason that I suspect a lot of people wouldn't immediately think of, is the WWE now has people bidding for WrestleMania. Mm-hmm. And that bid is based on the economic impact that WrestleMania brings to various cities. And a lot of that economic impact is stuff that is not explicitly WWE related. Now, don't get me wrong. Most of these people are still ultimately coming to WrestleMania itself. That's the destination in and of itself. But they're spending money in a multitude of ways at these other events that are, at least in theory, no way related to WWE.
Well, and so, in other towns even. I mean, you know, going back to WrestleMania 29. If PWS didn't run shows WrestleMania weekend to kind of piggyback off of WrestleMania as the word, since that's the word that's usually used, I don't know if I would use it myself otherwise. You know, and run these big shows with that, where they got, I think, I don't know if those are still the biggest crowds that they've ever had, but they might be. None of that money's going into the economy of Metuchen, New Jersey.
That's right. That's the thing. The economic impact spreads out. It's no longer just East Rutherford, New Jersey, or just Santa Clara, California. It is now basically the entire metropolitan area of the Bay Area. It is the entire metropolitan area of New York City.
Of New Orleans.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I mean, New Orleans is maybe the best example, given all the hardship and craziness that's happened over there over the last decade.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean, these are places that economic benefit is, you know, and that impact, the WWE themselves points to that and says to these cities, hey, bid for WrestleMania. You want it because it will help your town. It'll help your metropolitan area. It'll help your government. It'll help all – that's part of the pitch now for them.
And when it comes to bars and restaurants and stuff, I would say New Orleans would probably be the best example because I did not go last year. But every story you heard was basically that Bourbon Street was overrun by wrestling fans and wrestlers.
Well, let me put it this way. I went to WrestleMania 27 in Atlanta. And I actually didn't go to any event other than WrestleMania because the group I was with, it just wasn't feasible for me to go to any other event, unfortunately. But I was in an out and about town in that area, you know, for 2.5 to 3 days. And everywhere you went, you saw wrestling fans. And it wasn't just wrestling fans that were interested in WWE. It was people in Ring of Honor shirts. It was people, you know, I mean, this is kind of my point. And you can, and I'm sure people will listen to this and say, well, yes, but that's a minuscule impact and they wouldn't be there in the first place if it wasn't for WrestleMania. Yes, but the point is, by piggybacking, if you want to use that term, onto the WWE and what they're doing at these shows, there's way more money coming in than it would be if it was just the WWE. And the WWE uses that way more money to turn around and say, you want us to come to your town, oftentimes getting economic benefits out of it or getting deals out of it that they otherwise would not get. So the WWE benefits hugely from this. And while we can say, well, you know, WrestleCon is a relatively small piece of that, and these bootleggers should still be punished, or X, Y, or Z, whatever, counterfeiters, whatever term you want to use, the reality is, creating this sort of space around a WWE bubble, a 5-mile radius or whatever the case may be, might not be the smartest strategy in a lot of ways from them. I'm sure their approach probably at this point is, well, WrestleMania is as big as it's going to be, but they really do benefit, I think, a lot from the stuff that is non-WWE related. Including things like WrestleCon, including things like the Ring of Honor shows and the WWE and live shows and all this stuff. I mean, so all this is connected, and I don't think you can separate it, and the WWE benefits from it. So I don't know. This is a weird thing, and like you said, it's sealed or theoretically sealed. We don't know for sure.
I was a little too close to the mic there. If they filed one for this year's WrestleMania, it's sealed. Some of the past ones have been sealed and then got unsealed. I don't think any of them really came out at the time, although, I mean, people like me and Chris Harrington looking into them, that type of thing is more of a recent thing. But I don't remember, people necessarily reading stuff, actually trying to look for the documents and stuff at the time. And I don't remember, you get what I'm saying.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. I'm going to put you on the spot. Do you think we will hear other cases this year of the WWE effectively raiding vendors? I'll just use that term.
Well, did we hear anything about it at WrestleCon last year?
I don't recall hearing anything last year. Last I recall hearing was at 29.
At least in what I could find online in the stuff where they are arguing the case for last year, there wasn't anything about if they had raided. Well, you know what? Actually, wait. When did the initial legal decision against them come? Was it that week or was it later?
I couldn't tell you.
I want to say it was later. I want to say it was a couple months later. Does that sound right?
That's possible. I honestly don't remember.
Okay.
I'm well prepared.
I mean, we know they tried last year. We know they fought very hard in court to try to make sure that they don't get a precedent stopping them. So I'd be shocked if they haven't at least, or don't sometime this week, at least try to file the lawsuit.
Yeah.
How far are they going enforcing it? Because we heard nothing about anything at WrestleCon last year. I don't know.
I think that we will hear something this year. And the reason I say that is because the strategy of sort of creating the
Wait a second. I mean, it was right across the street last year, but how far from the stadium is WrestleCon's building this year?
That's a good question. It's got to be a ways away.
The only one that's actually – it's WWN Live is the only one that got a building within San Jose or Santa Clara proper, right?
I believe so. Yeah, okay. ROH is in Redwood City, and I don't know about the rest of the goings-on.
Okay, I will go to the WrestleCon site right now. You say something while I'm doing that.
Well, what I would say is I would bet that we will hear a story this year, because if WWE is effectively creating this ring around WrestleMania, yeah, if they're going to that extent as far as, you know, clearing out venues so indie shows can't run within that area for whatever reason, if that's their I find it hard to believe that we won't hear a story involving WrestleCon. Maybe not to the extent of 29. But I think something's going to come out of it.
They are in San Jose proper. I don't know how far it is from a stadium, but they are in San Jose proper at an airport hotel, the San Jose Garden Airport.
I am going to say, and we will revisit this possibly even on the next show, I am going to say that we will hear stories of something at that event related to WWE cease and desist or things of that nature.
I would lean towards that too because of the current mood and climate. Yes.
Yeah, I think it. I'm not 100% sure of that or anything else for that matter. But I feel pretty strongly that we're going to have something. So we will revisit that issue after the fact.
Well, I have one last thing I want to ask you though, because this has been kind of in the back of my head, because this is something they've done for years, and then WrestleCon was the first time we really ever heard about it. The first WrestleCon. Do you think the judges realize that this is covering anything beyond the general area of WrestleMania and people in the parking lots and stuff, and that 5 miles, I believe 5 miles is just the standard on this type of suit.
Awkward silence. I don't know.
Everything I've read never mentions other events or non-WWE events. It's always just talks about it being within the 5 mile radius, which WrestleCon that year was.
Yes. It was very close that year, actually. I would not be surprised if it was presented as being, you know, an on the doorstep sort of counterfeiting, you know, selling counterfeit product, like literally right out from under the nose of the WWE, which I guess theoretically you could argue that's exactly what it was. But I see what you're saying. Like,
well, because the confusion in the marketplace issue is not quite the same. I don't remember if they were arguing anything like that, but it's not, oh, it's right here at the stadium. That means it must be real.
Yeah, that's it's very different. I mean, and not only that, but let's be honest. From the perspective of authenticity, excuse me, outside of, you know, perhaps action figures, oddly enough, and in this case, the customs were pretty obviously not WWE official action figures.
Well, they were,
but
they were and they weren't.
Well, yes, they were in the same way that they are. The Samsung TV I have is a Samsung TV if I take it apart and construct a pyramid out of it. Mm. But that's not really the same thing.
Well, no.
I don't know. I would not be surprised if it was presented as very, very, very vague. And in this case, in the case of WrestleMania 29, I suppose you could argue, because of proximity, that it was sort of selling right underneath their nose. But the issue of authenticity, I think is kind of a disingenuous issue in this case, because most of the people who are buying something like this, they don't care if it's a WWE shop product. They could care less. Like let's be honest, if you go to wherever and there's two guys holding a Sheamus shirt for sale, and you're a Sheamus fan and you want to buy a Sheamus shirt, and one has a WWE shop logo or whatever that logo is on the back of it, and the other doesn't, and it's $5 cheaper, which one are you going to buy? I mean, you're going to buy the one that's $5 cheaper. You don't care that it's not authentic. I would say the number of people who care about authenticity when it relates to this specific issue,
wrestling shirts,
is very small.
I would agree with that. Yeah,
maybe I'm sure there are some people who will say that's bullshit. I'm the one exception to this rule. Okay, congratulations. I would say it's a very small percentage.
Well, I would say, do you remember what the Attitude Era looked like? Did you go to a flea market?
Yeah. Oh yes. Yeah. Absolutely. And of course, that raises the issue of secondary sales too. But that's a totally different issue. I would be willing to guess that, you know, the market confusion issue and like the authenticity issue, I think, is almost a silly issue to even inject into this, because I don't even think it's relevant, in so much as nobody buying these items is buying them because they think they're a WWE sanctioned item. I mean, that's
But they might think that it is. They may not be buying it because of that, but they may think that it is.
But if would they care? I mean, with the exception of collector's items,
of course,
you know, like maybe title belts, for example, like replica belts, or our action figures for people who are collectors of action figures.
In case someone was really good at faking them or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, with the exception of those things, I would say that when you're talking about items like posters, for example, or like shirts, or even, you know, nichier items that are like super obviously not like scarves, for example, somebody might make, which before you laugh, I'm sure there's people who do that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think people care at all. I don't even think they would care to look. And if they did look, and somebody said, well, you know, this is not authentic WWE. My suspicion would be that in 90% of cases, if not more, people would say, is it cheaper than what the WWE offers? And if the answer is yes, they will buy it.
A lot of these are really – the shirts are really ugly, by the way. A lot of these
– I'm sure they are.
I mean, they're not – most of them are not using like even the official design.
Look, they're wrestling shirts.
Well, yeah.
I mean –
well, you know what I mean. Badly reproduced. But, like, you know, I'm just scrolling through this –
there are not very many good wrestling shirts. In the history of wrestling shirts, there are not that many good ones.
Yeah. You know, I'm just scrolling through this a little before we finish up. The posters, at least the ones they show – were of then current WWE photos. Like, this is actually a weird one. I don't think it's taking a actual WWE poster. Like, it's The Rock from 2 years ago, kind of cut out with his logo and put in front of like an oceanfront background with like mountains in the distance.
That's like, tremendous.
And then now with the DVDs. Okay, I want you to guess what they put the value on these DVDs of. And by the way, the ones, okay, so the ones that we have pictured that we can make out, we've got Sunday Night Heat 2003 and 2004 complete sets, NXT Season 1, and Florida Championship Wrestling 2011. Now, as I said, the ones that they have front and center are all very obvious WWE trademark stuff.
Sure. A dumb thing to be selling at WrestleCon.
Yeah.
Sorry, I mean, I'm not trying to – I'm just saying, very stupid.
I was surprised when I saw them there, to be honest. I wasn't when I saw them at one of the smaller indie shows because it's like, okay, whatever. At WrestleCon,
dumb.
Yeah.
Dumb.
It's public record. It's a thing people already knew about, whatever. I mean, and he's kind of disappeared anyway. So anyway, the value. Okay, so this is, what are we saying this at? This is of 103 DVD sets that they seized. Total of 2,042 DVDs. And these are, how do I describe these? These are kind of the, they have the footprint of a CD jewel case, but they're black DVD cases with home inkjet printed, obviously home printed art, but that has the official logos in them. Okay.
That's stupid, too. Anyway, go ahead.
How much do you think WWE saying the value of those sets were? I have no idea if this is based on what he was charging or what, but...
Cumulatively?
This is what they have in the value. So, for example, 440 shirts, they valued at $20 each for $8,800. Poster boards, 28 poster boards, $25 each, $700. Action figures, they went with 11 at $30 each for $350. So DVDs, 103 sets equaling a total of 2,042 DVDs. What do you think WWE placed the value on the whole C's lot of DVDs there?
Oh, God. I have no idea, but I'm sure it's absurd.
Just throw a guess out.
$75,000.
Lower.
$50,000. $52,000. Okay, now...
Now, actually, wait. 52,000 divided by 103 is... Wait. 52...
We're doing math on the show today.
Well, it's supposed to be educational. Okay, wait. That's $504.85 each. I don't think he was charging that.
Yeah, well...
I guess the idea is that... Let's see how much that is per disc. Okay. 52... divided by 2042.
Riveting, folks.
Okay, $25.47. So they're saying each burnt DVD in these multi-DVD sets is worth $25.47.
Now think about back when this was a couple years ago. What were they? They were selling their three disc sets upon release for about that.
Yeah, I mean, maybe the official retail would be a little higher, but
official retail may have been 30 for three disc.
But, basically, you'd get for 20 or 25 usually.
Yeah. So we'll just say the official retail is 30, just for the sake of.
They are saying this is worth more money.
Yes, they're saying this is worth what, three times as much money.
The street value of this WWE branded heroin.
I mean, this illustrates how stupid this is. Okay? I mean, look, even if you are a hardcore believer in intellectual property rights, this is completely ridiculous. I mean, like, and the reality is, if anybody knows anything about tape trading, bootlegging, whatever term you want to know, the reality is pretty much anybody will tell you that the market value on the black market or the agora market or whatever term you want to use
is $1 per disc.
Is $1 per disc. So this is completely insane. I mean, it's totally crazy and arbitrary to the point of absurdity.
I don't know. I'm going to guess there were no like inkjet labels on the discs themselves or anything like that, or they weren't inkjet discs, which means that the cost of the discs themselves was probably 25 cents each.
Yeah.
And, the case at most in bulk would cost $1 at most, I would think. If you got them in bulk, if it's not in bulk, at the most $5, at the absolute most.
Yeah.
I had not actually paid that much attention to that the previous times I looked through this, but that is truly special, especially since the other numbers are not that outlandish. Figure, at $30 for an action figure, $25 for a poster, $20 for a shirt, I don't know what they were being sold for, but it's not outlandish.
Well, here's what's crazy about that. I don't know, at least in the DVD era, if the WWE has ever sold a single DVD item themselves for $25 a pop, ever.
The very first DVD ones might have been. The Possibly. Very first ones. Those Possibly. Were single disc. Possibly. Since then, anything that's single disc has always been... If anything's been single disc or two disc, it's always priced less.
Yeah. So this is... it's not based on the market, that's for sure.
No.
Not the bootleg market or the allegedly legit market. It's based on neither. It's based on fantasy, I suppose.
So, anyway, I think we actually got more out of that than I thought we would.
Well, hey, what are you going to do? This is the inaugural episode. We've got. We're going to go long. I mean, it's just the nature of the beast. But I think we're ready for the main event. Are we ready for the main event?
Because we pretty much covered whether or not we think they're going to do anything this weekend. So, which is really the only other thing to discuss, I guess. If we hadn't, done a central trip. So yeah, the main event.
David, I want you to start out. By telling us about your wonderful, and I'm saying that not sarcastically, I thought it was very well written.
Thank you.
Article in this week's Figure Four Weekly on this very main event issue. Well, largely on this main event issue.
Okay. Well, we had two things come up this week, and then we had a related thing, about a week or two earlier?
Yes.
Okay, so where do we want to start with it? Because it's really... I mean, we'll just start with really what happened. So I guess go in chronological order then, because the article covered the Sir Paul stuff too. So and we're already done with that. So first, a couple weeks ago, Tommy Dreamer wrote a Facebook post that a lot of websites picked up, talking about, and I think this was on the eve of his most recent House of Hardcore show, about piracy in his shows, and he was talking about. He's trying to run good shows, do interesting things, good safe place for everyone to work, which, yeah, by all accounts, he's running good shows that run on time, don't go too long.
Never heard anything bad about him. Never. As far as
paying well, everything. I mean, seems like he's been doing incredibly well as a promoter in every facet so far, in terms of live shows.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
And wrestler treatment. So he was talking about how the previous show, House of Hardcore 7, because this was right before House of Hardcore 8, he didn't really give any indication how many people actually bought the iPay-per-view, right?
No, not to my knowledge.
Okay. That it was on iPay-per-view, and I believe these have all been through RF Video now, right?
Yes.
Okay. Which I think we'll get into the Dreamer-Feinstein friendship. But so he talked about how – first he was talking about streams and torrents, live streams and torrents. But eventually he gave a number, which he said was just from one torrent site. And he made it clear that's from one torrent site alone, something like that. That number was 66,000 people had downloaded it. And he explained, you know, if those people all paid for it, that's life-changing money, which is a true statement. If all of those people had paid for it, that is life-changing money for him, for everyone who works for him, for indie wrestling in general, etc. The problem is, and oh, this was also in the context of him hiring some kind of anti-piracy company, you know, that tries to get stuff taken down. I would guess Take Down Piracy, because that's the one that seems to be working with wrestlers. I have no knowledge if that's it or at all, but, you know, they've worked with Colt Cabana, they've worked with other people. Anyway, he said 66,000. I cannot find any way in which that is possible. And this is the number they gave him. And you know what? I'm going to say, I'm going to make it clear, I really don't know if it's Take Down Piracy, because as far as I know, they do about as good a job as they can, and I would be surprised if they gave anyone a number like that, to be honest. So then, you know, let's start with this. Do you think whoever is doing this for him is who gave him that number? I think that he – or did he outright say that?
I can't remember exactly what he said.
I would have to find it.
I'm too lazy to look it up right this second, but you can do that while I pontificate on this. Let's just say for the sake of argument that the number is real, which I find to be exceptionally unlikely, to say the least. But let's just say that's a real number. If that is a real number and there are 66,000 people that downloaded that show, why is it that House of Hardcore is not the most talked about independent wrestling group in wrestling? Why, and people, oh, that's a weird point. I don't think it is a weird point. Because if you've got 66,000 people downloading your show, if the demand is that high illegally to download your show, how is he not the hottest thing in independent wrestling? Why isn't – I mean, look, he's done well. Don't get me wrong. But I find it very hard to believe that the profile of House of Hardcore is not bigger if that number is accurate. To give people an example of what I mean by this.
And this is nothing against House of Hardcore.
No, I think House of Hardcore's done a good job. I think Dreamer's done a good job as a promoter. But TNA, at the height of TNA, when they did the Samoa Joe versus Kurt Angle feud, this is about what they did in terms of buys.
It was 60,000.
For their biggest shows ever, okay? And this was before – I mean, piracy was an issue then, but it was nowhere near as widespread or easy to do as it is now. Let's just be honest.
This was 2006, right?
Or 2007.
Well, the biggest one was the one where Joe won, so that was actually 2008.
2008. May have been 2008, the cage match at Lockdown or whatever.
I mean, that was the last real successful show they had.
But, I mean, we're talking about 7 years ago. The landscape has changed dramatically when it comes to piracy in 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
Much, particularly when it comes to things like streams. Are you really telling me that I'm supposed to believe that House of Hardcore, on just one site alone, mind you, had more downloads than Kurt Angle's and Samoa Joe had buys for that TNA show, a show that has national television? It's just not believable. It defies belief to me. I just don't believe it. And on top of that, the other issue, which I think is the issue that you sort of cover, you know, in your article, is the implication that these 66,000 people would have bought the product. I think is a faulty implication. You know, the reality is, even if there are 66,000 people, they're not going to buy it, and they're absolutely not going to buy it at that price point with the track record of internet pay-per-views and wrestling companies, which are not the best.
Although, as he points out, he has not had any problems.
Never
with his
had
shows.
A problem, but it doesn't matter because he's tainted by what others have done.
The well has been poisoned.
Yeah, and that's unfortunate. That sucks.
It really is. I mean, for a lot of, you know, especially since, as I guess as our friend Adam Lash has put it, it's really not that hard to do, and everyone, I think he hasn't put it exactly this way, but he's pretty much never had any problems doing them for Smart Mark Video, and he is kind of working under the assumption that anyone who has had major problems consistently is doing it wrong.
Yeah, I mean, it, you know, if Chikara could do live Ustream videos of guys running around in an empty park in Philadelphia or whatever, playing a banjo,
and that went perfectly.
I mean, I just find it hard. This is absurd on its face, and I almost hate to say that because I don't have a problem with Tommy Dreamer, and I don't want this to come across as an attack on Tommy. Not because I care what he thinks of me, but because I don't, because I think he's done well with his promotion, and by all accounts, he's a nice guy, et cetera, et cetera.
And I want him to, and if somehow this got back to him, I would want him to understand what the reality of the situation is.
Sure, I just don't think that this is not a serious, it's just not a serious reality, the idea that all these people would be paying for this show, especially given the history of internet pay-per-view and pro wrestling, and even more so than that, given the price point, because when the WWE Network is $9.99 and New Japan World is $10 or a little bit less, depending on the exchange rate, it is very hard to turn around and say, hey guys, pay $15 or $20 a pop to watch this on your laptop. it's very hard to do that. It's not impossible. I've done it. I've paid for iPay-per-views and watched them on my laptop if there's a compelling enough card or match that I want to see or whatever. But it's very hard to justify at that current price point.
Yeah.
And that's something that has been ignored and deliberately obscured. And I think in at times in ways that I think are not so much by Dreamer, but by other people who have sort of piled on.
I know that I'm much more likely to buy an iPay-per-view if it's $10.
Oh, there's no question.
Even if going from 15 to 10, I'm more likely to say, yeah, sure.
No question. It's not even up for debate. I mean, and you know, people are like, oh, we can't afford that. Well, if you add 5,000 more buyers who wouldn't have bought it, I mean,
not that they're going to add 5,000,
the reality is they don't know. The reality is there's a fair market price for these things if you believe in markets. There's a fair market price for these sorts of things, and in the modern market, the way it's been dictated, 15 or 20 is not a fair market. It's just something that unless you've got a really exciting and dynamic card, you're only going to get a small amount of people who are going to pay that. I mean, I can tell you right now. If Dreamer's last iPay-per-view had been $10, there's a good chance I would have bought it. You know, if it had been $5, I absolutely would have bought it. At 15 or 20, I mean, you got to have a damn good show for me to even consider purchasing it at that price. And, you know, I think I'm going to get myself in trouble here, but I suspect I'm going to get myself in trouble a lot on this show.
Yeah.
So I'll take the heat for this, but you know, this is a concentrated effort, a concentrated anti-piracy effort. Dreamer wrote this first, and then, you know, Mike Johnson wrote an article, PW Insider, about the FWE promotion. And then right around the same time, shortly thereafter this, Rob Feinstein made a post on his Facebook, you know, talking about how he was working with all these groups together, and they were going to crack down on piracy. And
before we get ahead of ourselves too much, I did look up the Facebook post. Now, it's
sure.
Implied that the firm he hired gave him that number. It's a little confusing what he's talking about because it sounds like first he's talking about a streaming site. He says that what is it that he's saying? He's saying he got the site shut down. He was not able to do anything to the people who own the site, but he got the site shut down. That the sites were selling emails and other personal info to others, to quote other spam sites, and that people were getting viruses on their computer. And then he said at the end of the day, it was 66,000 illegal downloads. So if you do the math times $15, that would equal $990,000. That changes my life, et cetera. And then he's and he says, with that money, that happens, and that was just on one torrent site. So, I mean, if he doesn't understand the difference between torrents and streams, whatever. But I don't know what the site is that would have – that they would – A, that would have been shut down by whoever did this for him, that would have had that many viewers. And he said one torrent site. I mean, I tried looking around a little, you know, to see what I could find out. The biggest of the current – of the wrestling torrent sites that I know of – it had been down, and this was one that actually keeps track of how many people have finished downloading it, was about 1,000. The show was on the Pirate Bay, which I figured to check there, since that is the best-known general torrent site. That does not show how many people have downloaded it, and at least when I looked, and this, you know, it was, you know, however long after the show, a few months after the show, and, you know, maybe by that point, a week since he had posted, only had like one person seeding it, which with torrents, the more people that are seeding a file, which is they have the complete file, means it's faster and easier for other people to download it. So I just don't know. I just don't know where this information. I feel like someone's selling him a bag of goods, whoever it is, or bill of goods.
It seems very possible. I almost
badly embarrassed myself there.
I'm just trying to even construct. Well, like, was it a like, was it a stream with a chat room with 60,000 bots in it? I mean, I don't even know. Like, I literally can't even.
I mean, they said they got these sites. Seems like they got some kind of control of the site, though.
Yeah, it does. Which is interesting because that site, we don't know what that site is.
Yeah, and I mean, I do not keep up on this stuff too much. Like, the one site, should I give the name since I don't know if they still exist anymore? That one site that a lot of people had a lot of love and hate for because for a while they were the only source of Japanese stuff.
Oh. I'm not making.
Well, they went by a few names, so I mean, let's just call them Rudos then, because that was, I think, their group name. They I think eventually got shut down. I don't think they exist anymore. There are other sites. The only other site that I know of still exists, I think.
Yeah.
That might have been streaming it.
I just the idea of 66,000 in one place is hard to believe.
Well, and by the way, and those sites were both pay sites. The type of sites we're thinking of are pay sites. Most of the wrestling-centric sites would be pay sites, and would generally be the wrestling-centric sites that would carry something like House of Hardcore, at least live. If it was live. If it was live, then it was on a wrestling-centric site. If wrestling-centric site had... Maybe it was a pay site that had 66,000... No, that sounds high.
Didn't it turn out that only
a couple dozen people paid for the pay version of what Rudos had?
It's just not believable. And by the way, the fact that pay sites like that even exist suggests that there are people willing to pay for certain
services. And we should absolutely get into that.
Because that in and of itself illustrates that the idea that these are all freeloaders is not necessarily the case. But
I guess we should move on to the Mike Johnson thing now, because this is kind of multifaceted.
I think it's very incestuous. And I think, look, this is a concentrated effort. The idea that these people are all three, who I know for a fact are all connected to each other and all talk to each other, the idea that these three people just happened to do all these things simultaneously. It just happened to be that Tommy Dreamer wrote this thing that got a lot of traction. It just happened to be that Mike Johnson wrote this long article for PW Insider.
To be fair, about another promotion as the focus.
About FWE, yes, correct. The idea that Rob Feinstein just happened to post that, look, it didn't just happen to do it. This is an offensive on their part, you know. And there are issues here. You know, the one issue that I think will get me in trouble, and I could get some angry text messages about this, perhaps, mm-hmm. but I'll handle it if I do. That really irks me, particularly about Mike Johnson's piece.
And we should get into what he said, but I'll let you finish first.
Is, you know, he sort of chastised, and I'll let you loop around and talk about what he said after mm-hmm. I make this point. He sort of chastises people for, you know, effectively being freeloaders. Okay, that's effectively what Mike does. And look, let me be clear. I think people should pay for the wrestling that they think is good. Absolutely. And I think they should pay for the wrestling related products and services that they think are good.
And his
and
main...
if anybody thinks I'm a freeloader, I would note that I'm a subscriber to the Wrestling Observer newsletter, which, let's be honest, everybody knows. It's no secret. You can easily pirate the content there. No offense, David. You could easily pirate the content at almost anything in the modern universe. It's just the way it works.
And I just want to jump in for a second to add, and his main point, which was that there are a lot of people who go rah-rah support the indies who don't actually pay for anything.
Yes.
It's completely valid.
He's absolutely right about that. But here's, and this is going to get me in trouble, I guarantee.
And I'm glad that you're saying this and not me, because by the way, I agree with a lot of the things Mike said. So regardless of any personal animus that I may have for him or vice versa.
This is 100% on me.
Yes. I think
the idea that somebody who hasn't paid to go to a wrestling show in 15 years or however long is criticizing other people for being freeloaders is fucking ridiculous. This is a guy who has a job that he does very well, I might add. I think he's a very good reporter.
Yes.
I have been on record of saying that many times. I have defended his reporting from assholes who've criticized him unfairly many, many, many times, both publicly and privately. But this is a guy who the perk of his job is he gets to go to a lot of wrestling shows free. I'm not jealous of that. I think it's great that he's able to do that. I think that's part of the job. It is a benefit to him. And let me be clear. I don't know that he gets them all into all of them free. It's possible he buys tickets from time to time. And if he wants to correct me if he hears this, he is free to do that. But the reality is, this is a guy who lives off of wrestling, even though he is not a wrestler and not in the business. I have no objection to that because he provides a good and service that that people want to pay for. But when he goes to the majority of the shows he goes to, he does not pay for them. So I do not want to hear about people who are screwing the indies by not paying for services from the indies from a guy who doesn't pay to go to indie shows. I do. When I go to an indie, I pay, including indies that I could get into for free. I pay anyway. Maybe Mike does the same thing. To his credit, if I'm wrong, I'll eat crow. Maybe he pays every time. But I have pretty good reason to believe he doesn't. And it really irks me that that is a position that is being promoted by him because it's complete lack of self-awareness. this is a guy who is lecturing people on freeloading, and I don't think Mike's a freeloader. I want to make that clear. I don't. I would never use that term to describe what he does. Not in a million years. But you can't turn around and criticize people for allegedly never paying for anything when you don't know anything about them. When you're a guy who has a job where you get a lot of wrestling-related stuff for free. I mean, and to go a little bit farther, Mike is a guy, and the reality is everybody indulges in pirated content. Everybody benefits from pirated content on at least a personal level. I don't think there are very many people who are pure, and the perfect example of that in this scenario is Rob Feinstein, who we can get to in a minute. But I do want to backtrack a little bit now that I've gotten myself potentially in big trouble. And let you talk about what Mike Johnson wrote about FWE.
Okay, first, I'm actually going to step in and actually kind of defend from a person who does wrestling media stuff and has been to shows as media perspective. I mean, look, if he goes to every show and he's not doing a live thing for the website or whatever, and I'm saying this is an if. Because you're saying you're not sure. You think maybe he, even if he's going as media, he's still paying. It's possible, whatever.
It's possible.
There are different levels. If he goes to a show he would not have gone to anyway because someone offered, that's in a different realm from what you're talking about.
If I go to a show
that I'm not planning on going to otherwise.
If I'm sent a YouTube link of something that I would otherwise not have watched, how is that any different? How?
Not necessarily that different. But
other than the fact that I don't have a credential. I mean, I suppose the difference is, well, in one case, the company sanctions it, and the other, it doesn't. I mean, that's really what the difference is.
Well, yeah.
But you, from the perspective of what I'm specifically talking about, that's – anyway, go ahead. I stepped on your toes there.
I mean, look, if he or anyone else is pulling the thing that someone who I won't name, who I actually deal with regularly these days, used to be accused of – where of pulling the I'm important, I'm a wrestling journalist, whatever thing to get in free. If someone does that to try to do the, get into the especially smaller indie shows, no, that's terrible. Absolutely, that's terrible. It's a matter of what the person is actually doing.
Let me be clear.
Yeah, I want to.
I am not calling him a freeloader. I have no problem with him getting into these shows for free. Mm-hmm. I think it's technically part of his
job. You're saying
job.
The specific statement. The specific who support the indies without paying for the indies
that
statement.
That is my issue.
Yes.
You know, my issue is he would probably accuse me of being somebody who's not supporting the indies because I will go to Daily Motion sometimes or I'll go to a YouTube link of a match that was put up, for example. But I would almost guarantee that I have spent more money on independent wrestling in the last 10 years than Mike Johnson. how am I the freeloader?
Okay.
That is what I'm getting at. In no way am I saying he is one. I'm saying, how can you call me one if your premise is those who don't, you know, spend money on everything, basically, are freeloaders? How can you call me one given what your situation is? It's ridiculous.
So let's get to the rest of what he wrote, which is about a week and a half before we recorded this, and I'm sure we'll have this up within a couple of days of recording it. Family Wrestling Entertainment in New York ran a show, and it was a Wednesday night show, which is, I think we're going to get into that a bit, with the dream match, so to speak, main event of John Morrison against AJ Styles, 2 out of 3 falls. It was a Wednesday because it was the only day he was able to get both guys. So, okay, whatever. For some reason, originally the show had been scheduled in California. I have no clue why. Keep in mind, Family Wrestling Entertainment has only run shows in New York. Thank the Lord that fell through, and it did end up being run in Brooklyn. Have you heard anything about how specific about how that show did live?
No.
Oh, because, I mean, Johnson made a generalized statement about them drawing respectable crowds. And I don't know how much it applies to this show, because I would think that being on a Wednesday maybe could have even helped in some way on iPay-per-view, but I would think it would hurt them live.
Yes. That would be my guess.
Unless you're drawing from a specific neighborhood, then maybe, you know, whatever. But that's the show. They ran their usual type of show, which is a mix of some name guys, name indie guys. I have not seen any of their shows, it looked like a pretty good lineup, and apparently main event was really good. I did not see much promotion for it before it happened. I mean, I'm in the area, but there were no local ads, especially for, I guess, what's one of the bigger local indies now. There were no ads during Raw, local ads, although I have Verizon Fios, so I don't necessarily get the same ads as everyone else, especially if they're smaller ads. I did not get anything that there was nothing sent to the Wrestling Observer News Tips email that a lot of indies use for promotion.
No, hold on. I do want to say this real quick. David, would you say it's fair to say that I watch as much or more wrestling than anybody you know?
Yes, and I was about to get to that. So had you heard of this show at all in advance?
Maybe a day before.
Okay, yeah, and I think
that's telling.
Yeah, and I think it was the same thing. It was either the day of or the day before, someone was like, hey, why didn't you mention the FWE show? And I had not heard a word about it before. And you keep track of what shows are on iPay-per-view and stuff, even if you're not ordering them all.
Yes.
Because you're a guy who wants to know if everything's on tape or whatever, so you could eventually see it, etc.
Yes.
So between some local channels, and I don't always keep up with the local indies as much as I would like. I mean, like the really like more like New York-based ones, just because they are a little far, more far-flung than you would expect, I guess because of the cost. Which, I mean, do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Because of being in New York, like, I mean, you know, no one's running Manhattan besides Ring of Honor, and that's kind of to be expected. But even for Brooklyn, it's, you can get there via one of the main subway lines that'll come in from other parts of the city, but it's not like it's centrally located or anything. And then on Long Island, you have Mikey Whipwreck's Indie, and Evolve has run the same building, and it's just, it's not, you know, again, it's not centrally located if someone were to take a train, and again, it's even, or even if someone's driving, it's relatively far out on Long Island. So, just in general, that because of that, I'm not necessarily going to keep up with them as much, because for they're not necessarily it's, you know what I mean? It's not like it's just a quick trip and I can go, and whatever. I don't necessarily have to excuse that, but I feel I'm going to qualify it a little in case for some reason it should have been on my radar if I had kept up with those more and I wasn't. So, whatever. Because I feel like I don't want to put that on them too much, even though we're probably going to put a lot more on the promotion later. So where were we? So, right. So I didn't hear anything, I think, till the day of. And I think I tried to look after someone tweeted me about it. And I couldn't really find much. So the show happens. And really what pissed off the promoter, Jordan Schneider, was that within an hour of the end of the show, the main event was on, I believe, YouTube and Daily Motion. Which is especially egregious, but he then kind of, I mean, what he was saying, I wanted to fall on the sword. And he talked about, I guess, having bigger goals and that it was on torrent sites. And they talked about, Johnson talked about it was on torrent sites. His customers were sending links to him for days after. Some showed over 10,000 views, which, keep in mind, for YouTube views, they may not have watched the whole match. YouTube, I believe, takes a view with any, if the video loads at all, right?
Yeah.
I think the same for Daily Motion. So if someone clicks the link, they look at it for a second. That's a view, but whatever. I can understand the sentiment. Let's see what he coded. It's Snyder saying, it's frustrating to see people complain about there not being alternatives and preach support indie wrestling and then post a bootleg link on the same page. And yeah, if people posted it on his own Facebook and not like, hey, you should get this taken down, they're kind of being dicks.
I agree with that.
But what was he saying? No matter what I say, someone's going to complain about me mentioning this, but the reality is all it hurts the bottom line, not just me, but anyone promoting at this level. Oh, and it does. Yeah, and then, you know, Mike Johnson talking about FWE's biggest enemy is itself, trying to present something unique, trying to grow and make money. That there were more on the YouTube counter before he would ever... YouTube accounts than there would be pay-per-view buys or DVD sales ever.
Let me say this.
Yeah.
Mike is right when he says FWE's greatest enemy is itself.
Yeah, let's get into that. Should we get into that
because,
now?
Because here's the problem with this, and I have no animus toward this guy.
Seems like he's a very I don't know about how well the shows draw, but at least in terms of how he treats the wrestlers, seems to be a liked promoter.
I do not want to pick on this guy. I don't really want to pick on anybody.
I mean, I don't know this guy at all.
I'm just look.
None of this is intended to be really insulting anyone.
Think about this for a second.
This is supposed to be real talk for the lack of a better term.
Suppose we were talking about, like, suppose this was Herb Abrams, for example, the infamous promoter of the UWF, and I don't mean the good UWF. And he was talking about grandiose expansion plans, and he canceled a show and then or changed the location of the show on relatively short notice, and he decided he was going to book this. Do this solely because he really wanted to get this dream match between these two particular guys that he was really into, and he was even willing to do it on a admittedly sort of bizarre night. He would be like, if we were writing a history of the UWF, and
then Bruiser Brody no-showed because he was dead.
if we were writing a history of the UWF, and we included that sort of narrative. Everybody would agree. Well, Herb Abrams is crazy to do that. That's nuts. Why would you do all that stuff? But because of the evil pirates, we're supposed to ignore what I think are some pretty obvious problems with this show right out of the gate.
So it seems like ever since the video subsidized model of indie wrestling became a thing, it became in vogue to blame any business shortfalls on piracy.
Yes, absolutely.
Whether it had to do with the actual distribution of the video or not. Again, I have no idea how this show might have drawn surprisingly well for a Wednesday, but also, to preface anything we're about to say, I have no idea how this show was budgeted by what it would have to, but just running in Brooklyn on a Wednesday night, I just don't see how we could have made money on the live gate.
Okay, look.
Well, AJ Styles costs what, $2,500?
He's not cheap.
And Morrison, I think, is in the same range.
But
and a hotel and everything, yeah.
But here's the thing. Why is AJ Styles and John Morrison a dream match? Why?
Work rate.
Why is work rate matter? Why do we care about that? They didn't care about it in the '80s. Junkyard Dog was a huge star. Why do we care about work rate? Is it maybe because of
WWE?
Tape trading?
Well,
is that why?
I was going to give another joke explanation. I was going to say WWE is full of slobs like Bryan Danielson and Claudio Castagnoli.
I mean, dude, look, the reality but yeah, tape is trading. The very existence of these super match indies is predicated on piracy. That's the entire basis of their existence. Is these are people that people are talking about because they watch them on YouTube, they watch them on torrent sites, they watch them on Daily Motion, and if you go far enough back, they watch them on DVD or they watch them on tape. That is how these people make their name. They don't make their name through national promotions. You know how I know? Because they don't work for them. They don't make their name through.
Well, in this case, this case, not necessarily.
Well, but no, even in this case, because how did AJ Styles get his job with TNA? I mean, look.
Well, he was an X Division guy, but he was also in a promotion that was well connected to TNA.
Sure, but if you trace the timeline back far enough, tape trading is the origin of all this stuff, and the entire idea of a promoter. I mean, if you look, there were no promoters who were interested in booking dream matches prior to tape trading. You know who the tape trade? You know who the first guys to book, dream matches were?
Dennis Corluzzo and Joel Goodhart.
And Joel Goodhart and John McAdam.
And to an extent, maybe Sam DeSera.
And who were those guys?
And what's his name? And why am I forgetting his name? Mike Ratner.
They were tape traders.
Yeah.
That's who they were.
Maybe Sam DeSera wasn't, but I mean,
the entire idea of dream match promoting was and still is based on people who trade tapes.
I mean, let's talk about what else Joel Goodhart did. Joel Goodhart ran several bus trips from Philly to Memphis. Where would these people have gotten the idea to see Memphis wrestling?
I don't know. I guess they just thought.
And they would take a bus from Philadelphia to Memphis.
You know what it was? They read PWI and they just envisioned how good it was. Yeah. Maybe that's what it was. I mean, it's just, look, the reality is tape trading has subsidized smart fan culture. There would be no Wrestling Observer without tape trading. That's just true.
And no, that's literally true.
That's an absolute fact.
No, because remember how and why Dave started The Observer. Dave was trading tapes. He was writing letters to everyone he was trading tapes with to talk about the shows he was watching. He realized, wait a second, I am writing the same letter to everyone. Yeah. And I'm just rewriting it over and over. So I will write a newsletter with my observations on the different territories I'm watching tapes of, and I will distribute that to who I am trading tapes with.
Now literally
how The Observer started.
Here's the thing about this, okay? Now, you could make the argument, okay, well, just because it was done then doesn't mean that it should be done now. But here's the problem. When you say that, what you're really saying is, now that us we, the people who have assets and have control of certain wrestling things or sites or tape libraries or promotions or whatever, now that we have benefited from what we are now calling theft, we want to now invoke monopoly privilege so that nobody else can benefit from it. And I think that is a fundamentally absurd argument. So when I hear somebody like Rob Feinstein complain about piracy, I mean, this is a guy who's literally the most successful pirate in the history of wrestling piracy. I think that's a fair statement.
I will say this is going to sound like a strange statement, but to be fair, as far as we can tell, his biggest selling stuff was all stuff he did have the rights to.
Oh, and he's done some masterful stuff. Like somehow he has the rights to all that ECW footage. You know, which you would assume may not have been his, but he's managed to. Good on Rob.
And by the way, I mean, I've looked into this a lot over the years, and I mean, I've even talked to Rob about it, and I don't just have his word for it. He somehow struck a deal when he made his original deal with ECW that somehow lasted beyond ECW.
Yeah.
All the credit to him. I don't even want to bring up Heyman because people will read it wrong. But
he has the rights to the TV. He can legally sell the
TV.
Well,
that's what surprised people. People knew he owned the rights to the fan cams because he shot those. He didn't shoot them. His company shot those and he owned those. People knew that. When he started to sell the TV later after ECW didn't exist anymore, people were like, hey, wait, what's this? And eventually it really came out. Whatever Heyman or Gordon or whoever signed with him lasted to be on ECW. And apparently the same also went for Smoky Mountain and USWA.
Yes. So, you know, good on Rob for that. But the reality is Rob built his empire on selling other people's stuff. To a large extent.
He didn't because the ECW was by far the biggest selling, and I get it. But he did. I mean, of course he did. You know,
yeah,
I think
did.
I don't even think.
I don't even
would
know
he say
he
it out loud
that.
On a podcast?
Yeah,
but I'm never, sure he'd admit it in conversation.
Of course he would. Of course he would. So to hear him complain about piracy is ridiculous. It's a textbook example of people who flout IP for years and then turn around and want to invoke it to their benefit. In other words, IP is something I ignore and don't treat seriously and don't even act like it's real whenever it benefits me. But the moment that it potentially harms me, well, then I'm going to invoke it. It's just nonsense. I can't take that argument seriously. And I missed this earlier on the Dreamer thing. I did want to make this point. Mm-hmm. I joked to you about this yesterday. I find it especially rich that Tommy Dreamer is going so hard on the – and don't get me wrong. I understand why he is. But I find it especially rich that he's gone so hard on this piracy issue, and then he runs a show where Justin Roberts does a shoot promo angle at the show, which is based around Justin Roberts being pissed off that the WWE issued an IP claim against his demo reel. I mean, how ridiculous can you be? Like, it's just comical on the face of it. You know, I mean, he's not even consistently anti-IP at the moment.
I'm going to defend that because when you get into the actual details, I would say that Roberts has a little bit of a legitimate beef because...
Well, assuming that WWE actually agreed to let him have that, which we don't know.
Yes. Now, even if they didn't, WWE generally, unless it's something they really don't want on there, and we can get in, and whether or not they we're actually screwing
for people who don't know what we're talking about, Justin Roberts got pissed off at the WWE because his demo reel, which was on YouTube, they got pulled down. That's what we're talking about.
Right. WWE generally, this shocked a lot of people after the network started. WWE generally, if stuff gets flagged, and by the way, this is automated. WWE's whole digitized library is fingerprinted and in sync with YouTube. Like, if you upload something that WWE has digitized on their servers, their in-house servers, it'll get matched. And then WWE usually, you know, adds some ads along the side of those videos. They only pull stuff that they really don't want on their current recent pay-per-views, whole stuff that's on the net, complete stuff that's on the network, stuff like that. For them to actually, if that it did get pulled does make me think it's possible that someone did intervene, and yeah, that's not great. So I just wanted to put that out there because it won't shock me if we end up talking about that topic anyway, of kind of the whole WWE YouTube thing eventually.
It'll come up.
I'm sure it will at some point. So where were we actually? You came in with Dreamer and...
Well,
oh, I know where we're gonna go. So we have all this stuff where the optics of someone who perhaps made money on bootlegging really going hard after other bootlegs, pirate streams, whatever. There's also the issue which you brought up, and I really agreed with very strongly and I will now, but also in Figure 4. It became a normalized part of hardcore wrestling fandom.
Yes.
And for better or for worse, it's going to be very, very hard to overcome.
And especially hard to come because of how expanded that fandom it is.
Especially in the last, what would you say?
I'd say 3 to 4 years.
I would say, yeah, the furthest I would go would be Punk's promo before Money in the Bank.
I mean, honestly, I think...
So for you know, a little less than 4 years.
I've made this point on the Wrestling Culture Podcast, cheap plug there. But I've made this point there and elsewhere that I believe smart fan culture is close to the mainstream wrestling culture now. I think it's very difficult to separate the two anymore. Well, at least when you're talking about adult fans. Children fans are obviously a separate market. But even there, I mean, you know, it's very rare that I go to a wrestling show now and there's not some kid my daughter's age, my daughter's 12, who's telling me about what he read on some scoop site or, you know, telling his buddies about it. So even that, I think, is – even that sort of – has been, you know, it's been with tweens. I think there's even a huge influence,
and there are different degrees of it. Certainly,
oh, absolutely. I mean,
you know, Bleacher Report is the biggest. I guess is well, no, it is the biggest non WWE site, and they pretty much only cover WWE. So you're not. Yes, it covers most of the stuff from a smark viewpoint, for lack of a better term, but. It only covers WWE. If you're going there, you're not really going to find stuff about New Japan or even Lucha Underground or whatever.
Yes, that's correct. I mean, there are certainly different degrees. There are hugely different degrees. Huge.
And then
different.
Reddit has, I would say, meant a lot. Twitter has meant a lot.
Yes.
I wouldn't shock me if WWE pushing hashtags on Twitter led to people discovering people who were more hardcore using the hashtag, hardcore in the sense we think of it, using the hashtags, and then discovering it from that. Because the whole point of everyone using the hashtag, besides WWE bragging about their stats, is that there's some people who just follow everything on the hashtag.
Yes, absolutely correct. I think the point here is, even if you find, you know, even if you consider all this stuff theft, you find it morally wrong. You think it's legally wrong, which it is legally wrong. I mean, it's illegal. Even if you are totally principally opposed to all of it across the board, and I'd say the number of people who in practice are is probably less than 0.1%. But let's just suppose you're in that small, unbelievably small minority. I think that... The reality is that it is a normalized practice, and it has been for some time. Piracy is not just a part of smart fan culture; it is central to smart fan culture. Rob Feinstein does not have a job related to wrestling without piracy. That's an obvious example, but the reality is neither does David Bixenspan, neither does Mike Johnson. You know, I mean, nobody that's involved in that way does, period. And the reality, and going even further than that, it's hard to envision certain wrestlers who we've all come to know and love, people who are very highly regarded as workers or talents or whatever, who would have gotten into wrestling or gotten as good as they did, if not for effectively piracy through the form of tape trading and DVD buying and things of that nature. And I don't even necessarily want to name names, but we know who I'm talking about. I think most people know who I'm talking
about. And hell, think about this. if you want to go back a long time, I mean, even early internet era, the first, like, well, not the first, but one of the first really centralized wrestling discussion areas, which was the Grandstand on AOL in their sports section. They had a more like hardcore wrestling area that was had a lot of good discussion. It had a tape reading section.
Yes. Of course. Of course.
And this was an AOL-run, AOL-sanctioned, I think moderated, I think even by actual AOL employees, message board.
Yeah. This has been, you know, again, I think it's too – I think it's – to even say it's a part of smart fan culture, I think is wrong. It's central to it.
That's taking it lightly, yeah.
It's central. It's one of the central components of, if not the single central component of, is – piracy in the broad sense of the term. Tape trading, watching YouTube links that aren't supposed to be up, watching Daily Motion links that aren't supposed to be up, you know, reading a news article that's, you know, basically been stolen, if that's the term you want to use, from another site. Look, that's what we do. And you can say, well, I don't do that. I find it highly unlikely that there is a single wrestling fan in existence that has not clicked on a YouTube link that is not approved by whatever company owns the IP.
Or a site with that had galleries of old magazine scans.
That's right. It is the chances of that are so small, unless you're the Ted Kaczynski of wrestling fandom and you're holed up in a bunker somewhere. It is virtually impossible to believe. Now you may say, well, I don't know that, or I can't be, I'm not culpable because somebody put this up and I just clicked the link. I didn't actively seek it out. And maybe we can argue that there's different degrees of it. I think most people would agree with that. I think, but the reality is if you're a hardcore smartphone, whatever term you want to use, you have benefited from piracy. And you know, going forward on this show, I think I am going to argue that a lot of wrestling promotions have benefited from piracy, including wrestling promotions that are very popular today. I think New Japan has benefited immensely from piracy.
I think they've even admitted it. It wasn't the thing about seeing the amounts of torrent downloads in the West something that actually came from New Japan and on Daily Motion?
I don't doubt that one bit. I am a subscriber to New Japan World because they put out a product that I am willing to pay for. Prior to that, did I watch things on Daily Motion? Of course I did.
And then recently, within the last week or two, when there was the latest New Japan scrub of Daily Motion, the thing that people got upset about was primarily stuff that's not on New Japan World.
That's right. Stuff that doesn't exist on New Japan World because
whether it's old or recent, yeah,
people want
to see
the access, and they will pay for the access if it is a company or a brand or a wrestler or a promoter, whoever, who they have loyalty to. They will pay for it if the product is something that they really think is good and if it is presented to them at what they perceive to be a fair market price. And guess what? If you believe in markets, the fair market price is not whatever the promoter says it is. It's whatever the majority of people are willing to pay. that's how markets work. If you object to markets, that's a different discussion. But if you believe in markets, the market price is what people are willing to pay, not what the promoter says it is. If a promoter, you know, charges $50,000 for a show and nobody shows up, it's, you know, the promoter didn't get screwed by fans. That's not how this works. Mm. Of course, that's a hyperbolic example, but the point stands. We will get into the indie business model in greater detail, I'm sure, at times over the course of this, because there are going forward on this series, because there are absolutely indie promoters who have done it right, who are doing well. And a lot of them,
Family Wrestling Entertainment, to be fair, they did experiment with stuff like doing a whole live stream of a show on YouTube.
Absolutely. If you want to talk about it, another thing that sort of popped up this week, Smash Wrestling out of the Toronto area in Canada has come out with an on-demand service where everything is up, and I think it's like $7.50. I have no clue how they're going to do. I hope they do well, but I think it's an interesting concept. And they're a company that has released free downloads on their site. Mm-hmm. They have tons of free content that is on YouTube. So, you know, they are – they've gone about creating a buzz about themselves. And I have a feeling this could be a successful venture for them because they have used social media and the existing technology to their advantage. And I think that is something that a lot of just doing an iPay-per-view just because you can is not what indie promoters should be doing. That's ultimately what it comes down to. The ability to do it is not an argument for doing it.
Well, you know what I'll say though? If you're using a third party like a GoFight Live, isn't there no upfront fee?
I think so. I think you're right.
Isn't it straight 50-50?
I think that's right.
It's not the worst idea.
No.
I mean,
no.
I don't think it's a bad idea. No.
I'm not saying it's an explicitly bad idea.
But people aren't just going to buy it cuz it's there.
That's right. That's the point. You know, you can't just charge whatever you feel is what you would ideally like to get, you know.
Well, look at Impact Zone Wrestling. I would guess their deal with GoFight Live was that they had their own equipment and GoFight Live just became an outlet for them. They don't have a huge following, but they certainly have a bigger following than they would have otherwise if they didn't stream their shows for free each week.
Yes.
Which I presume is still going on.
I mean, a lot of places like this, there are a lot of different ways that you can use existing technology. And iPay-per-view is a viable one. There's nothing wrong with it, but you can't price yourself out of the market. And I don't like the idea of torrenting or streaming and things of that nature being pointed to as the reason your business is failing or the reason a show didn't do well.
Well, let's go to the one you talked about earlier that I hate to interrupt, but I think you're going this direction anyway.
No, go ahead.
You talked about this a little in passing. I talked about this in Figure 4. I understand if they're limited to that it pretty much has to be a flash stream in a browser because of whatever hurdles there are to get it onto other devices. If it has to be that, you have to, one, price it like that because it's an inherently a lesser product than what I am getting from WWE Network, from Netflix, from Amazon, from Hulu, from MLB.TV, etc.
Correct.
And also, you have to really push whatever I can do to get it onto my TV as hard as you possibly can. And the easiest one for everyone to get behind would be Chromecast. It's $35, sometimes less, depending on where you can get it. You just plug it into your TV or your receiver. You have the plug-in for Chrome on your computer, and it can stream anything that's in Chrome to your TV. And the quality, it depends on your connection and your computer because it is redoing it. It's capturing what's on your screen and sending it to the TV. So I mean, there are issues there. But if someone doesn't want to hook up their laptop to their TV, that's pretty much the only option most of the time. You have to rally around it. You don't have to give it away or anything, but push that it is possible. Because the average person may not know that. And that's what drives me crazy. And then Roku, which is the more, I guess, normal consumer-friendly solution, it's really the only platform where you can actually build a channel or app or whatever you want to call it fairly easily. And that has a lot of third-party content creators on it. But, I mean, there are only a couple of note that have wrestling. I mean, WWN Live and GoFight Live are the biggest ones I can think of.
AAW has a Roku,
okay.
I believe.
And good for them, but it's only one platform. Not everyone's going to adopt it. And if you're not using some kind of united, if someone doesn't somehow, no one's going to all play nice and figure out how to all have their one channel. So you have to treat it as a lesser product. And then, you know, with some of these things like WWN Live, don't get me wrong, I get along well with Gabe these days, and actually he posted probably one of the funniest things I've seen in a while on Twitter recently. I don't know if you saw this.
The vanity search thing?
Yes.
Yes, that was amusing.
It was just for those who didn't see it. I don't remember if it was Rich or Joe from Voices of Wrestling. They were talking about the argument between Brandon Stroud from Uproxx and Frank the Clown. Noted WWE fan Frank the Clown. And the Stroud had made a comment about Frank the what Frank the Clown said after, when people were saying negative things about him compared to the fans who were dressed up as wrestlers that were made to change their clothes in Des Moines. Anyway, this is getting way too far from the original topic, but he got angry at Stroud for tweeting him and not tweeting about him, but not tweeting at him. And I don't remember if it was Richard Joe, but they said, no, if you're not tweeting at the person, that is them not trying to pick a fight. If you then tweet at them, that's on you. If you tweet back at them and get really upset about it, that is on you. I mean, unless they're really unless it's like really over the top trolling nastiness, but which is not what that was. So anyway, Gabe Sapolsky, and we're getting way off course, but I feel the need to explain this. Tweeted or replied to Voices of Wrestling saying something like, what was the word? He was like, you assholes. Do you know how many tweets with the word Gabe I have to go through before I find the right ones? Which I love seeing because it shows how self-aware Gabe is these days, and that's awesome.
Yes. And by the way, I should say that Gabe is a guy who puts out a product that I really enjoy now, and I will be buying at least some of the WWN live stuff over Mania weekend.
Me too, as I did last year.
Yep.
So
as I did last year.
Oh, so where
and
was
the year
I?
Before.
I have no idea how much impact Gabe has with the overall operation compared to Sal, whose last name I can never pronounce right. Sal Hamwai. Can we go with that?
We'll go with that.
I get the feeling Gabe did not until recently have the best understanding of some of the stuff from looking at his Twitter. And I say this in the sense of that I hope he does. But for his sake, for the promotion's sake, etc. Like, how long had people been asking for a WWN Live Roku channel? Pretty much from when it started, right?
That's pretty fair, I think.
And they've been around now, what, 4 years? Five years?
Something like that.
The Roku channel started what, last year?
Yes.
And when did Gabe first tweet about getting a Roku? A couple months ago?
Something like that.
And it was, this is not verbatim, but it's true to what he said. Oh my God, I can't believe this. I got a Roku. This completely changed the way I watch TV.
Yes, that's, I think, pretty close to what he said.
Great. He understands it now. But you see that and you get the feeling he didn't before.
I don't think a lot of these people get it before.
There's the other thing with Gabe, and this is more current because I think he totally gets it now that he has a Roku. Did you see it where he was kind of frustrated by the Kimberly, Chris Dickinson video getting so many views?
Yes.
I don't remember who was explaining it to him, but they were like, well, A, it's inflammatory, it's viral. Because he was upset that none of the Evolve videos had, and I believe he did use the term, gone viral. And someone's explaining it to him, well, A, the Kimberly thing was all sorts of inflammatory, and I believe the one that got all the views was like, Guy Pat Rauer bubs his girlfriend, der-ba-der-ba-der. Right? And someone was like, well, that's why that drew so many views, as terrible as it is to say. But also, you're only putting up highlight videos. And I don't know if I saw Gabe reply or not. The highlight videos are not going to draw people in. I mean, I don't know. I'm guessing Evolve does well enough on iPay-Per-View. And apparently their Long Island show actually did well live, but at least by the standards of, what NYWC draws in the same building. But I've never seen anything on Evolve's channel that would make me want to buy a show.
No. I mean, here's the reality. You need to use the YouTube platform as the way to get people to buy iPay-Per-Views.
And you need to show old matches and stuff like that, or recent matches, or you need to be willing to give stuff away.
Sample thing. Like, I'll give you a perfect example of something that worked on me. Beyond Wrestling, put up some content for free they put up actually a fair amount of their content for free. And, I decided I really wanted to see one of the matches that was not free. on their channel, and I went and bought the show. Now they price their shows they are only available on YouTube unless you buy the DVDs, and they price them very cheaply. I think it's like $5 for a show. I mean, but that's the point. You're watching it on YouTube. $4 or $5 is about what you should be paying.
And I think actually with YouTube, I do think live. I think it's harder to set up a pay per view or whatever. I don't know if you can get YouTube if you're a smaller company on there, but I think you can watch that type of paid YouTube stuff on a device, right?
You probably could. You probably could. But my point is,
impulse buys, etc. If it's a browser based product.
Yes, and for $5, I've bought a few Beyond shows. So
yeah,
that's kind of my point. There are ways to do this, and I don't want to pick. I hope this doesn't come across as throwing cheap shots at the FWE guy, Jordan Snyder, whatever his name is. That's not what my intention is. I'm just saying, generally speaking, I think there's a lot of I don't like the idea of piracy being blamed for a show not doing as well, because it rests on a whole lot of assumptions. It ignores the fact that piracy, to a large degree, is the reason that these companies exist in the first place in a lot of these cases.
And in this case, it was all after the fact that we were talking about.
Yeah, and it ignores other issues related to the promoting, which in this case, there's a couple of pretty obvious ones, I think. They ran on a Wednesday. They switched the place from California to Brooklyn. I don't know how short the notice was, but the point is it was switched. He was dead set on getting this particular match, you know. Look, there's nothing wrong with any of those things if that's what you want to do, but that raises the level of risk. And to turn around and sort of, you know, have an article written that says what – I think the title of the article is What Killed FWE or something of that nature. The implication is that what killed FWE is piracy. Well,
FWE is not necessarily dead yet, by the way.
No, they're not.
Kind of hypothetical.
They're not. But the point is FWE probably wouldn't even exist without piracy. And on top of that, even if you want to throw that aside as sort of a philosophical argument – the reality is there are other issues there, and it's, I think, very short-sighted, at almost to the point of being propaganda to claim that the real issue FWE may or may not be struggling is piracy and nothing else. I just think that's really – I think it's dishonest, frankly. I think it's fundamentally dishonest to make that argument because I don't believe Mike Johnson actually believes that. Again, here I am getting myself in trouble. But to be fair,
I don't think he was necessarily arguing with that in that case. I think he was using it to make a more general argument.
I don't think he was necessarily arguing that, other than the fact that I think that title I have a big problem with.
Yeah.
Because the title implies more than the – I actually thought – look, I thought the article was well written.
Yeah.
I thought it was a very well put together explanation of the struggle that content creators and wrestling promoters have over this issue.
And he gave an especially good example. He mentioned our friend John Filipowicz's Barbed Wire City documentary.
To get my bias out of the way, my literal friend, John Filipowicz, he pointed to that, the creator of Barbed Wire City, like you said. That's a tough one. You're talking about somebody who did dedicate years to this project.
And with that, we're talking about something like that and Wrestling Road Diaries that would just end up on YouTube all the time.
Yeah.
And just the whole thing would be on YouTube. And when people see something like that on YouTube, they don't necessarily – that's the type of thing people don't always realize is not kosher when they see it on YouTube.
Yes, and also it's worth noting that a lot of the people, a lot of the time, the people who create that content aren't even going to bother to flag it because they don't even think it's worth the trouble.
Yeah.
I don't want to completely bury the article because I tweeted out when I first read it that I thought it was a well-written
content. And I thought that was a specifically good example because of what I just said, though, which is that's piracy where people, I don't want to call it accidental piracy, but I would say, there were torrents, but that's going to happen with everything, the torrents. The YouTube stuff, that doesn't necessarily happen to everything.
No, that's true.
It's more likely to actually hurt them.
That's true. I agree with that.
Because a lot of the people on torrents and stuff, they're not going to buy it anyway.
And somebody who's in the position of somebody like John is going to – it's going to be more difficult for them to exploit a platform like a Roku or like whatever to get this out there. I mean, that's just true. Yeah. When you're not affiliated with a promotion or it's tougher. So that's tough. And I'll be the first to say I don't have an answer for that. I don't know what the answer is. So it's a legitimate point that Mike Johnson raised in that article. One other thing I do want to address about that article is there was sort of an undercurrent of, well, what about the smaller guys? What about these guys who don't have the big names? Because the theory, because throughout the piece, Johnson sort of made arguments about, well, you might think you're just ripping off the corporate wrestlers or these guys who have all this money already. And, what they're millionaires. Who gives a shit? Which I'm sure that with some people who are into the piracy scene, there is some of that. I don't doubt that. But I don't know that that's the prevailing viewpoint. But even if it is, he sort of talks about, what about the smaller wrestlers? What about the wrestlers who are, lesser known? Or they're indie fixtures and they're trying to get, exposure or whatever, blah, blah. And I understood his point, and I didn't think it was a completely irrelevant point, but I thought it was an odd point to make in an article that was based around a company that decided to book a dream match between two cast off. To me, I know of a lot of promotions in the South that do pretty darn well with virtually no name, so-called name guys that run weekly or biweekly and draw, 100, 200 people a show, which is not bad for an indie. And these guys do well. And some of these guys go on to get signed by the WWE. Great example of that would be Steven Walters, who's really a Southern indie guy for the most part, who's in developmental now with NXT. But I just think if you're the little guy argument, sort of, it's a novel argument, and I understand what Mike was trying to argue, and I don't entirely dismiss it, but the little guy argument to me says, maybe these little guys, and I hate even using that term, maybe these local fixtures, maybe those should be the focus of your promotion in the first place. Mm-hmm. Maybe instead of spending a few thousand dollars minimum to book these dream matches, you should be pushing are promoting these other guys in the top slots with one WWE or former WWE guy or whatever.
And book them in an ongoing story or whatever, which, to be fair, House of Hardcore does.
Absolutely. I feel like that's a model that can work really, really well. I've seen it work really, really well, frankly. And it's a model that sort of goes – but you know what model it goes against? It goes against the Dream Match, Tape Trader, piracy-based model because – in that model, what really matters is work rate and all that type of stuff. So I don't know. I'm just very – there's a lot of stuff in this piece, and we could microanalyze it to death. I think we probably already have. But is there anything else you wanted to touch on regarding this?
Well, let's see. I mean, I wrote in my thing and we touched on some – the way that piracy is – what was the word you used to – because we said it wasn't just part of. It was...
central.
The way it is central to hardcore wrestling fandom, it's a hurdle that there's not... I'm not sure how you get past it. And you can do things, like I suggested, we talked about some of them here, to make the product more appealing in a way that might be more for an impulse buy or whatever. Like, for example, I think I mentioned, I'm not crazy about the WWN Live thing where an impulse buy costs more. If you buy it the day of the show, it costs more. I unless they have figured out somehow that actually works out better for them, I don't think so. Well, if just for the reason we talked about earlier, I'm a lot more likely to buy a show if it's $10. It's $15 the day of. I don't think that works for them. I think charging more to have the ability to watch it on demand later is not a great idea, because if people aren't necessarily going to trust iPay-per-view, they want to know
that, hey, if I'm buying it, I'll be able to watch what I missed right after, or something like that.
Yes.
I think that, to be honest, the on-demand download should be, or it should be a download. It should be an MP4 file. It shouldn't be something that you stream from the site. It should be something you can watch anywhere, where you want, on whatever device you want. Again, so you have that comfort, even if you're not really explaining it that much, even if you just use whatever player they have on their site instead of downloading it. But there's always that fear, like wrestling promoters have, that, oh no, I put a digital file out in the open, that means it's more likely to get pirated. No, people are pirating the stream. They're pirating the DVDs. There have been so many companies that like were slow to go with downloads, even though they put out DVDs, which always blew my mind. But like DVDs somehow don't go online. But I think you need to package it in an appealing way. I think really, unless an indie absolutely knows they can do good business with it, and frankly, maybe if they are doing good business, maybe experiment with some cheaper shows too. But I think most indies should not go beyond $10, and I think they should try to include the on-demand with it and try to include it in an easy-to-use way. I think that's something more companies should try.
I completely agree with all that. So does my cat, who's like running around underfoot. I apologize.
Well, and I would say I've probably bought more internet pay-per-views from WWE Live than anyone else combined if it was a show I was already intrigued by in advance, because I knew it would only be $10.
Yes, that's the thing. Like I will buy shows if, you know. And here's the thing: I bought a $15 show recently. I bought the Atlanta ROH show, which wasn't even a live show. It was an after the fact on demand because it got critical reviews and it was widely praised. And here's the more important thing: I wanted to reward ROH because I think their product generally has been very good lately. And as a consumer, I like to reward companies that present a good, consistent product. You know, that's another part of this. If you promote 8 shows a year and 3 or 4 of them are clusterfucks that underperform and they're kind of critically loathed, it's going to be tough to convince me to spend $15 or $20 on another show, no matter what the card is. You know, that's sort of a bigger picture argument, but I don't think you can completely ignore that, because I mean, we see that with WWE. People bitch and they say, I'm going to get rid of the network. And of course, that's, I think more often than not, it's all talk. But I know people who've gotten rid of the network, you know, and the point is, people will pay, people have brand loyalty in wrestling, either to wrestlers or to, companies, or even to promoters. There are people who will say they'll buy any Gabe show. I've heard that before, you know. So there is a brand loyalty thing that people have where they will spend the money if you cultivate that relationship. And I think some promotions do a very, very good job of that. I think other promotions don't do such a good job of that. And I think that is something that you have to do. I mean, the example I always point to, which is not a wrestling example, but it's a music example, is probably my favorite band currently in existence is Lucero, and they release a, you know, album every few years, and on they themselves release put the entire thing on their YouTube page the day it comes out. And people say, my God, that's counterintuitive. Why would you do that? Like, that's an insane thing to do. But yet they continue to sell records and they tour a lot and they have a ton of brand loyalty because people really love going to their live shows because they're extremely fun band to see live. So they do that, and if anything, it endears them to their audience. I'm not suggesting that wrestling promoters put all their content out for free, but my point is, if you create a people who are loyal to you and who believe in you and believe in the product that you're putting out, people will spend money on it. Mm-hmm. And anybody who says they don't, that they won't do that, if you really believe that, then how does PW Insider exist? How does the Wrestling Observer exist? I mean, these things would not exist if people did not have loyalty in Mike Johnson or Dave Meltzer or Brian Alvarez or David Bixenspan. If people did not trust these people, they would not spend money on these websites. So I you know, for anybody who says, it's unrealistic and you have to crush the pirates because people will never voluntarily spend their money on this. No, that's not true. I just don't think that's true at all.
Something else I wanted to ask you. How well do you think it would do if I'm trying to figure out if I would scale it to different sizes of promotions, whatever. If some promotion tried experimenting with the kind of pay whatever price you want type show. Depending on whether or not you allowed people to choose zero.
I think I would say there's no harm in trying it.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on where you are as a promotion. I wouldn't counsel somebody to run their first experiment in that vein that way. I think that's way too risky. But if you're an established company, it might not be a bad idea. Let me put it this way. You know, voicesofwrestling.com put out the New Japan yearbook last year, 2014. And it was, you know, you could download it for free. You could pay money for it if you wanted. Now, look, I have no clue what the numbers on that were. I don't know. But I do know that Rich Kreitsch, who runs the site, was surprised by the number of people who paid for it.
And who used the name your own price feature specifically?
Yes, I mean he was not, you know, and on their Twitter feed, both Joe and Rich were saying, get it for free if you want. We don't care. They weren't even encouraging people to donate money.
Right.
They were literally going on the Twitter feed saying, you can get it for free. We don't care. I don't even think I saw one tweet from those guys that said, you know, oh, we'd like a $2 donation, or oh, it'd be cool if you did this. Nothing. It was all basically, you can get it for free if you want. If you want to donate, whatever. And again, it's not like they cleaned up and made a ton of money. I don't believe that's the case. But I know for a fact that they were surprised by the number of people that volunteered to spend money on the item. So,
and I've had that happen with a few of the people who bought Fall Guys using PayHip.
Sure. So I think there may be something to that.
Well, the most important thing is, though? You learn what people actually value the show at.
Yeah, you learn what the market is. That's a good point. You have an idea of what the market price actually is and what the demand is for it too, and that's a good point. I mean, it's not the worst idea in the world. I can already hear people sort of cynically saying that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
But it's a proven model. I mean, it's been enough. I mean, you need to have a following of some kind to make it work to the degree you want it to. You know, the big example would be Radiohead, but I would like to see whether it's a Beyond or a Smash or even an Evolve, someone like, or just, and I, like, I don't think an R, I don't think it works for something like an ROH, but these days, but anyone like that, just kind of experiment with it. I think they have room to. I mean, certainly Beyond does if they're charging only $5, and you know, with something like Beyond, it wouldn't shock me if people ended up. If they got, a surprising amount of people who may have paid more than the usual five.
That's very possible. I don't think that's out of the realm of possibility at all. And here's the other thing with that. The other reality there is that a lot of people who were paying nothing because they were torrenting it or ripping it off, they may actually pay money in that case. Now, I'm not saying they would for sure.
But they might just put down a dollar. They might be like, okay, I paid for it.
But a dollar,
now I feel better about myself.
A dollar is better than nothing. Yeah. And the reality is those people, you know, if somebody's – most of those people are not going to pay 10 or 15. They're just not. So it may not be the worst idea in the world. That may not be the worst idea in the world to as a test model.
Now, the other thing I wanted to – mentions that, and I don't know how you get past this. I mean, well, it's kind of twofold. Content consumption keeps moving away, though, from that one thing for X amount of money model. You know, DVDs are, they're not dead, but we're not in the DVD boom is long gone. More and more, it's all you can eat. WWE Network, Netflix, Hulu Plus, Amazon Prime, you know, even CBS.com or whatever. All, it's that type of thing. I think in the long run, that hurts pro wrestling companies who are trying to do, you know, buy X show for Y amount of money. But the problem is most companies wouldn't be able to sustain it on their own. Do you think enough could work together to try to do some sort of indie I guess indie Netflix, indie WWE Network.
If you had asked me this question maybe 6 months ago, I would have said no. But I think the Raw alternative, or Raw alternative, or however the fuck they've,
yeah.
I think that indicates that there might be a window for that. I don't know how big the window is. You know, I don't know how many people who would actually be willing to do that. Because I think with a lot of these companies, they want to push the brand itself.
Yeah.
But.
Well, and also who's willing to work together in the first place.
Yes. But I think it is possible that could be. And I ultimately, I agree with you. I think in the long run, if these guys want to survive pushing out any sort of digital content like this, this is the model they're going to have to go to. In the long run. I mean, in the immediate, not necessarily. But in 10 years, look, in 10 years, if you don't have some sort of streaming option, you know, that or on-demand feature option, I don't know how viable you're going to be. I just don't know.
The NWA service turns into something like that. Suddenly becomes the key to NWA membership.
The NWA service that Bruce Tharp announced this week, and which apparently is going to include a lot of, you know, old Houston footage, and the Smash service, both being announced this week, I think indicate that companies are thinking more along those lines, including companies and promotions that you wouldn't necessarily think would be thinking upon those lines, because the business model that they've been operating under for years has been DVDs or pay-per-views or whatever, and maybe they realize that that's not where it's at anymore. I think that's a really strong possibility. Another thing, too, you could eventually see is, and I think we've already seen this, is, you know, the sort of a la carte menu of matches you can choose.
Like, I was just going to mention that, like Click Wrestle,
Beyond does that. They'll charge 99 cents for certain matches and stuff of that nature. Black Terry Jr., the camcorder god of Mexico, independent Mexican wrestling, does that. So there's a market for that, because people will buy that. If brand loyalty, people like, you know, I don't know how big the market is, but there absolutely is a market for it. So
I don't think there's enough awareness of it.
There probably isn't, but that may change over time. That could be something to change over time, because it's not that different from downloading something on iTunes for,
yeah.
You know, it's basically the same principle. So and it's the epitome of an impulse buy, because it's like less than you spend on a cup of coffee. You know, Black Terry Juniors are a little bit more expensive, but you're getting something that literally nobody else can give you. Yeah. No one else. I mean, so yeah, I think that those are all models that we can look at as future models, and that we will discuss as future models in more detail on this show.
Yeah. Now, I guess to kind of close that off, though, why do you think that indie promotions are so relatively unwilling to go to kind of try different models when it comes to video distribution?
Part of it, I think, is there's already a risk associated with running indie wrestling, a large risk, let's be honest. And I think there's a fear that any extra risk is a guarantee of failure, which is, frankly, something I think that's understandable. I think another problem is that a lot of the indie model, in a lot of cases, can be really antiquated in terms of how things are done. I mean, there are indie promoters and promotions, maybe even ones we've talked about today, who, you know, still do the bit where, you know, you take 20 tickets and you're a wrestler and you're required to sell 20 tickets to your buddies or get donations from the local whoever. And that's how you, I mean, and I'm not saying that model is irrelevant. I think that works for a lot of indie promoters. Don't get me wrong, but it is an old model. And I think there's a tendency within indie promotions to sort of stick to what is safest. Stick to what is known, because if you go too far off the reservation, so to speak, you might be getting yourself into territory that is either unknown or that crosses somebody else who maybe is a promoter locally that you don't want to piss off, or who, you know, I just feel like there's a lot of fear of incurring extra risk. And I think it is very understandable, which is why I think a group of them working together on some sort of streaming service could potentially be a great idea, because it minimizes the risk for everyone. But it is a tough hurdle to cross, I think. You know, it's because it's not like you have a lot of resources. Of course, the flip side of that is if you're promoting with the idea that iPay-per-view is going to be your savior at $15 or $20 a pop, you've got another thing coming.
Yeah. One thought I want to add to kind of close with, I remember, you know, well, first I was going to say to what you just said, you know, a little over a decade ago, subsidizing the shows on the tape sales was an incredibly risky business model, and maybe in the long run, I think it still was, but, you know, I'm surprised that no one, now that it's such an intrinsic part, and now that at least the DVD sale part mattering is kind of dead. I mean, I think ROH still sells DVDs, but I never hear anything about anyone buying them. So I don't get why no one's really wanting to move on. And one thing, I guess, really just to close with, I remember thinking back to a post Norm Connors made somewhere years ago. Now, Norm Connors, longtime Pittsburgh promoter, wrestling, well-known wrestling fan, etc. Very nice guy, very well-respected as an indie promoter, always put on very good shows, first with Steel City Wrestling and then International Wrestling Cartel. I remember him writing that by far the most they brought in from DVD sales was when they did the really cheap DVD sales. Because the expenses are so low anyway, that once they did, I think it was maybe a $5 DVD sale, that's when they sold the vast majority of their DVDs.
Yeah.
And I think there needs to be a lesson learned from that. Especially now, with the way that prices and the prices people are willing to pay for that sort of thing have changed so much.
I'll wrap this full circle by saying this. Let's suppose Tommy Dreamer is right, and there were 66,000 people in just that one torrent site or on stream, because he doesn't know. Let's just assume that it's 66. That's the correct number. Let's just take that for the sake of argument. Let's just assume that half of those people – no, actually not even half. Let's
quarter.
Go lower. A quarter. Let's just say that just a quarter of those people – or a third or whatever
are willing to pay.
We're willing to pay $5 or maybe even $8, $7.95, which I think is a reasonable price for the live iPay-per-view. Tommy Dreamer has just made himself what, $250,000? You know, like, or a hundred over, it's into the six figures, you know, and that is enough money, you know, to quote him, or to paraphrase him, to change his life. So, you know, there may be something too. If that torrent site does in fact exist, perhaps the lesson there is not just that people are dicks for not paying for this, but that maybe if our prices were a little bit lower, the market is even bigger than we thought for our service. Because I guarantee you he couldn't have thought – in fact, he alludes to that in the article, that he didn't think – he was amazed that there was that many people. Like, not just in that there was that many people who stole it, but that there was that many people who gave a shit.
Right.
So maybe that's telling in its own way, even if you accept that number as a real one.
Right. And again, it's the price thing, because WWE Network, as I said, I think a lot of people agreed with, I'm sure you agree with, at this point – if someone can get WWE Network and they're only pirating the pay-per-views, guess what? They're never those are the people who are never, ever, 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 ever going to pay.
Yes, they're never going to pay. Yeah, I agree with that 100%.
And while we're dealing with a different scale going from, you know, $60 to $10, hey, they did pick up a hell of a lot of people that, whether it's by percentage-wise, however you want to put it, that weren't buying pay-per-views.
Yeah, there were not a million people buying every pay-per-view.
And they had, you know, we've
seen, or 600,000 for that matter.
Right, and
they had, and I guess continue to have, much bigger risk than the indie promotions would have doing the same thing. An indie promotion, and an indie promotion would be more likely to do it as a one-off or to do it slowly the way WWE should have, but that's a whole other thing. So I guess that's it for today.
We covered a lot of ground. My voice is actually going out, which never happens.
Oh, boy.
This is a rare occurrence. It's rare. And I've got, you know, now it's time for us to plug everything else we do here at the end of the show. I've got a WrestleMania sort of preview of both the main card and all the indie shows, which I will buy several of, for the record, despite my philosophical opposition to IP. me and Dave Musgrave on the Wrestling Culture Podcast will be doing that. Possibly the show will be up before then, I'm not sure. But if not, and you are listening to this show and you haven't heard that show, you should go listen to that, Place to Be Nation. That's my main cheap plug for now. What are your cheap plugs today?
Cheap plugs. So, you know, as always, check me out doing the daily updates, as well as Figure Four Weekly each week for subscribers at WrestlingObserver.com. What else do I have going on? Fighting Spirit Magazine, the current issue, which, yeah, that just came out, so it'll be the current issue whenever you hear this, which is probably within a few days of us recording it, has an article from me going over the 20th anniversary of the Weekly Pro Wrestling Tokyo Dome show from 1995 with the 13 different promotions and the various matches and some of the politics around that. And what else? You can, on Kindle, as I mentioned earlier, I put out the first Kindle version of the, what would you say, landmark, seminal, all of the above wrestling book, Fall Guys?
Yeah, I think that's, I think all of the above fits.
Which Dylan has promised to review at some point at voicesofwrestling.com.
I still got it, and I will review it, but it probably will not be till the end of my school semester. So maybe another month.
I've got some other things, you know, trying to put it at some point, as constantly promised, I think I will. Well, I'll be setting up the feed for it for this anyway. So expect some kind of new, more regular podcast from me start very soon. And also, yeah, I just made sure as we were finishing recording this that, yes, in addition to whatever of my own feed we put this on, this will be mixed into the feed at voicesofwrestling.com.
Where I am a semi-regular contributor.
So I guess now I am also a semi-regular contributor.
This is the longest plug outro ever, and neither one of us has mentioned our Twitter yet.
Yes, so to follow Dylan on Twitter, it's at Dylan Waco. To follow me, it's at David Bix, and I guess that's it. Do you want to fade us into the non-existent music?
Yes. Here, everybody, just imagine that there is music that we've paid for, of course.
As we know, all indie promotions do,
especially House of Hardcore. Just imagine that there's music fading us out. Thank you for joining us on the inaugural episode of The Trademarks. And we'll be back hopefully pretty soon. We're going to try and make this at least a monthly occurrence. If there's anything that you listened to on the show that infuriated you, pissed you off, excited you, you disagreed with, you agreed with, you loved, you thought was smart, insight of, whatever the case may be, again, you can tweet us at David Bix or at Dylan Waco. Any suggestions are welcome. Any comments are welcome. And once again, thank you for listening.